You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
On Flashpoints, an in-depth report on the future of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in exile and virtual incommunicado at the Ecuadorian embassy in Great Britain. We'll speak to legendary filmmaker and longtime Assange friend John Pilger, and in the second half of this collaboration with Randy Credico's Live on the Fly, we'll be joined by political activist Christine Assange, one of the most effective defenders of Julian Assange, and she happens to be his mom. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. And joining us in one moment from New York City is my good brother, Randy Credico of Live on the Fly. WikiLeaks whistleblower Julian Assange, who has been forced to take sanctuary at the Ecuadorian embassy since 2012 to ward off prosecution from the UK and the US, has now had his internet access cut off. Assange has played a key role, a crucial and courageous role in letting the public in many countries know about the massive malfeasance and outright crimes of their elected officials and corporate leaders. Indeed, WikiLeaks and Assange has been the go-to publisher for whistleblowers to get their truths out, truths that have often highlighted the duplicity, deep corruption, and outright lying of governments throughout the world. In a new world order where high-profile journalists have been transformed into corporate state propagandists, WikiLeaks stands out in their dogged pursuit of truth and exposing deep-seated corruption and graft. In this defiance in seeking truth and bringing light to criminality, asserts the online news site Truthdig, that has earned WikiLeaks in general and Julian Assange specifically the scorn and contempt of the power brokers in D.C. and throughout this world. Today, in this continuing collaboration with my good friend and colleague Randy Credico, we pick up the trail again and try and shed some light on the crucial case of Julian Assange and why he should finally be freed from further prosecution so he can get on unfettered with the great work WikiLeaks has done as one of the most significant publishers in modern history. So joining us, as I said, is also Randy Credico and our good friend, noted filmmaker, many, many films, one of my heroes, John Pilger. John Pilger, welcome back to Flashpoints. We are glad to have you with us on this hour in which we're discussing the future of Julian Assange.
Thank you, Dennis. Very good to be back on the program.
Well, great to have you back. There's some changes going on at the embassy there. They've cut off his internet. You know, that's his lifeblood, his lifeline. He's been living in that small room for so many years, and now they're trying to make it a little bit smaller. You want to give us your best understanding of what's going on now? Have you spoken to him? How's he doing? What's the strategy now? What's happening?
No, I haven't spoken to Julian. It's not possible to speak to Julian. They've done more than cut off the internet. They've cut off the phone. The Ecuadorian authorities have placed a blocker on the on all communications in the embassy, and perhaps worst of all, he is denied visitors. And I'm not sure exactly what the latest situation is. I know that his lawyers are meeting today, and there is possibly a meeting with the Ecuadorians. But beyond that, I don't know any more. But you can appreciate, Dennis, the effect of these measures on somebody who has been effectively imprisoned in a very small space without sunlight for now coming up to 6 years. This is cruelty. It's cruelty, and it's a great shame. It's tragic that it's coming from the government of a small country that recognized the justice in the Julian Assange case and gave him political asylum in the embassy. But, you know, this, of course, the government of Ecuador is a tiny government. I'm not excusing in any way this new government's actions in doing what it is doing, but it is under direct pressure from the United States, which is rolling back so many of the so-called progressive governments in Latin America. I mean, they cut off the communications with Julian just a day after the government at Ecuador welcomed a delegation from the U.S. Southern Command, and that's the Pentagon's arm in Latin America and the Caribbean. It was headed by Southcom's deputy military commander, General DeSalvo. And they arrived in Quito to discuss bringing Ecuador back into the American fold. Whether that's coincidental or not, I don't know. But I doubt it. I mean, we must ask, did the Pentagon's people deliver a blunt directive to their Ecuadorian counterparts to silence Assange? I don't know. But there is a combination here of a government that has certainly in Ecuador has tried almost everything to bring a real measure of justice to Julian. It has tried to negotiate with the British government. It has called on the British government to give Julian free passage out of the embassy, and he has a right to this. The United Nations Working Party on Unlawful Detentions makes it very clear that he is being held, effectively held, detained unlawfully, and he should have right of passage. He's not even given right of passage to a hospital, or rather they're saying, yes, you can go to hospital, but we can't guarantee that you'll be allowed back. There's a particular cruelty being imposed on Julian Assange, and in my opinion, it's because he is the embodiment of dissent that is so missing from right across the political spectrum in Western countries, the dissent that should be vivid in the capitals of Western countries and is missing. Julian Assange is the embodiment. He is of that dissent. It's as if he is the he represents what the enemy, and it's become an enemy to the governments in the West, and the enemy is dissent. It's free speech. I mean, taking away his right to speak, his right to communicate, his right telephone, his right to receive visitors, is an attack on freedom of speech. It's an attack on our rights as well as his. But he seems to be the embodiment of that. He is an extraordinarily courageous individual. I don't think I've known anyone quite as, I was going to say resilient, but it's much more than that, quite as openly courageous, defiantly courageous as he is. What isn't courageous is those who should be giving support to Julian Assange, those who regard themselves as opposed to authoritarian governments and the totalitarian actions of governments, of democratic governments, those who call themselves the opposition, who are silent. Those people are not courageous, they are craven. So we have something happening to one individual that is something we should all be concerned about, but it represents something much broader than that.
You know, John Pillager, I do equate Julian Assange with folks like Daniel Ellsberg, who, in a way, he's a very special kind of publisher that has an impact on sort of structural history and the way we're going to remember it. But at the bottom here, at the core, it's almost as if there's a cynical chorus of fake journalists, I don't know what to call them, corporate journalists who scoff at truth tellers, who it's almost like out of style to tell the truth, to do your job, to really report. And he takes this seriously, so he keeps going.
Yes. Well, that's correct, Dennis, I have been a journalist for quite a long time, and I always thought, regarded journalism as having a certain duty, and the duty was to find a way of telling the truth, finding a way of finding out what the real story was, finding the facts out, and giving them to the public. We served the public. That was the duty. It was rather simple, actually. It was long before people were called investigative journalists, because all journalism should be investigative with the object of finding out the truth. Julian Assange is being mistreated in this way because he is doing what a journalist, a true journalist, should do. He has done what a true journalist should have done, and that is to find out the truth, especially about those who seek to manipulate and control our lives and rule over us, and by telling that truth, to call them to account. That is... What I've just said, as I understand, is written in certain documents that are often read out in journalism schools. And that's what he's done. And for that, he is being subjected to a form of torture, being denied all contact is a form of torture. It used to be called sensory deprivation. It's a form of that. My point is that he needs our support, and he needs it more urgently than ever.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We are delighted to be joined by, I don't know if that's the right word, but I am damn glad that joining us now is Randy Credico. He's the producer of Live on the Fly. He joins us from New York City. Randy, here we go. one more attempt to tell the truth about Julian Assange.
Yes. Dennis, can you hear me okay?
Perfectly.
Okay. Well, Dennis, it was like almost a year ago when I started and you joined in, and between the two of us, we've done 20 specials on Julian Assange. I think maybe this is the 21st. And John, you kicked it off April 5th last year. You were on for the first half, and he was on for the second half, and then we started rolling from there. By now, I was so optimistic then that he would be out of this jam. A few months later, Sweden dropped these bogus charges against him, and everything looked optimistic. What is your sense of where they are at this point? The British government, the U.S. government, where Ecuador is, and trying to keep him away, get him into the U.S. I mean, where is he going from here, do you think?
Randy, what is happening to Julian is part of a campaign and a very aggressive campaign. It's a campaign against democracy. It's a campaign against dissent. And it's a campaign against the truth of what governments do behind our backs getting out. And I think what is happening at the moment is that campaign is at a critical stage. Here we've seen the provocation of Russia. We have the biggest military build-up since World War II on the western borders of Russia. At the same time, we have the biggest military build-up since World War II in the Pacific. Both of these, in the northern hemisphere by NATO and the United States, in the southern hemisphere in the Pacific, by the United States. The issue here for Western governments and the great power of the United States is that power has been challenged, not militarily challenged, but the dominance of the United States has been challenged. That is intolerable. And that campaign to confront and provoke the two powers that are perceived to challenge it, Russia and China, is reaching some kind of critical mass. It's very, very dangerous. There's a great deal of talk about a trade war. We can forget a trade war. What we should be talking about is the real threat becoming almost a prospect of a shooting war. The provocations on Russia now are so extreme. This Skripal episode in Britain has been exposed as a series of fabrications, clearly. In the last couple of days, the chief executive officer of Porton Down Scientific Laboratory, where this particular nerve gas agent has been analyzed and chemical and nerve agents have been produced, has hauled the rug from right beneath the British Prime Minister and the British Foreign Secretary and indeed the whole British national security and military establishment in saying that there is no evidence, they have no evidence that can be verified that Russia is the cause of this. There's a lot more detail to this that you haven't got time for on this program, I know, that we could go into that would reinforce that. It's no more a suspicion, I think. The whole thing is some appalling fabrication. But why? It's part of this almost inexorable campaign now to reach a point with Russia and to some degree with China, but mostly with Russia, where Russia has to respond, and it has to respond militarily. Wars begin in this way. The First World War began in this way. I think this is now more dangerous than at any time during the First Cold War. So the WikiLeaks has played an important role in bringing the truth out, and I emphasize the truth out about
We just lost John Pilger. We have never lost him before. Randy, we're gonna call John back.
Okay.
But he was just obviously he was making an incredibly important point, which we, of course, confronted with Craig Murray
2 weeks ago. Two weeks ago.
In the idea of this phony Russian story. And now John is just saying that this is one of those stories that leads us into, the beginnings of World War III. Obviously, we're going to do our best to get him back on the line. We're calling him right now. But your thoughts, go on.
Yes. Well, here we spoke to Craig Murray 2 weeks ago. Everything that he said on this show, he broke it first on your show. And 2 weeks later, what he said back then has borne fruit. And the British government has had to retract some of their absolute statements about Russian collusion, Russian involvement. There was what he called a Russian to judgment back then. And so what he said was prescient, and what you're seeing right now is the result of British intentions to incriminate Russia and to basically instigate a step up of the Cold War, of a modern Cold War. So what Craig Murray said back then, I spoke to him yesterday, it is amazing. And it was right here on Flashpoint where that story was broken.
Perfect. Okay, I think we've got John Pilger back on the line. John, we lost you there at a crucial point. But we've got you back now.
Let me just ask you a follow-up, John, on this. John, this connection with Russia and Julian Assange. It was just 2 weeks ago, Dennis and I were talking about that when you disappeared, when Craig Murray was on the show talking about that this was a Russian to judgment. So at about that time, Julian Assange, three things happened. One, you had this guy, Alan Duncan, Sir Alan Duncan, from the House of Lords, calling Julian Assange a worm. And then you have this tweet by Julian Assange on the situation in Germany, the arrest of Puigdemont. And then you had Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. They started to question the official story at Salisbury and those attacks. And so I don't know what the rationale is for Lenin. What are your thoughts on that?
The rationale for the Ecuadorian president, why he's doing
yes.
Yeah.
Those three things seem
well,
to be done.
I would only be speculating, Randy, and as I said at the beginning, I think this is mostly pressure. The Carreras government in Ecuador was something of an aberration. Governments like that of Chavez and others in Latin America, particularly in Bolivia, are aberrations in the history of a country, of a continent deeply impoverished and controlled by the United States. And the United States is taking back control. That's its campaign in Latin America. And with the ascent of a new president, Lenin Moreno, he seems rather more amenable to the idea of Ecuador having a traditional relationship with the United States rather than being independent from the United States. That's really all I know. I'm not an expert on Ecuadorian politics, but I don't think it's terribly difficult to work out that the U.S. has brought pressure for the Ecuadorians to act, and as I mentioned, the deputy head of Southern Command, U.S. Southern Command, was arriving in Quito at about the same time. Now, none of this really is surprising. It was probably inevitable, but it's certainly the latest in a long campaign against WikiLeaks. It's a campaign that criminalizes journalism, and that's what we've seen happen. What has happened to WikiLeaks is the criminalizing of journalism. A document which WikiLeaks was leaked from 2008 made it clear that an organization within the Pentagon called the Cyber Assessment Department, I think I may have it right, laid down what the plan would be as far as WikiLeaks was concerned. And they made it very clear that discrediting WikiLeaks, the way to do that was to destroy trust in it and to destroy its founder and editor, Julian Assange. Now, that is 10 years ago. That was the plan. That plan basically is being carried out. And it's the... this document makes very clear that the threat was truth, that WikiLeaks would do as journalists should do, and that is tell the truth about government strategic plans, its war plans. It came 5 years after the invasion of Iraq, in which governments, the United States and Britain especially, lied that they were weapons of mass destruction. That was the justification for the invasion of Iraq, which killed possibly about 1 million people and caused the flight of some 4 million others from Iraq. That compares, in my view, with this poisoning case in Salisbury as an ignition, if you like, for another war. But it's not simply a war with a Middle Eastern country. They're talking about a war with the world's second most powerfully nuclear-armed state, Russia. Because the propaganda around the Salisbury episode feels very much like the propaganda around weapons of mass destruction before that was exposed.
Is this our Gulf of Tonkin, John Pilger? Is this in the class of creating the incident you need for the war? Is that what we're talking about?
I'm sorry, I missed the beginning.
Is this sort of another Gulf of Tonkin?
Yes.
Babies in the respirators being ripped out in Kuwait. Are we?
Yes, the Gulf of Tonkin sounds pretty mild compared with some of the fabrications and bogus situations that have led to wars since then. I think Iraq is probably the best example, but yes, you could say it is a justification for, if not an invasion. I mean, because the idea that NATO would invade Russia is so insane, if not an invasion, then a sort of war of attrition, a kind of constant war of intimidation, which, as the president of Russia made clear, the Russians have no intention of accepting. They've upgraded their nuclear arsenal, and it's prepared for this. That's what makes all of this so bordering on a kind of collective insanity. Why is Britain doing what it's doing? That is a question I struggle to answer. Yes, I know the pat answers that it's so joined at the hip with the United States, and here's a possibility of a Britain in post-Brexit being seen as in a kind of new quasi-imperial role and respected for its might and power and wisdom and all that nonsense. But I don't think that makes sense, because this can only end in the most horrific war that would devastate both sides, and particularly exposed countries like Great Britain. And you know, at the center of this are those who stand against it, and they have to be swept aside one by one, and the most prominent clearly is Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. I mean, when you think back to the 2016 and the leaked emails of John Podesta that revealed the direct connection between the Clintons, the Clinton Foundation, and the funding of organized jihadism in the Middle East, and the founding of ISIS, which is the most horrific source of much of Islamic terrorism, bringing it right back to Saudi Arabia, which is central to the American and British armaments industry. That one revelation tells us more of the machinations of great power than most journalism I can think of for many years. The same was true of the WikiLeaks revelations of collateral damage. Collateral murder.
Yes.
I beg your pardon. Collateral murder that Chelsea Manning leaked. The power of that single video of an American gunship helicopter mowing down people and children, the power of that was such that it informed people all around the world of how wars are conducted by their own governments.
That's all in it.
And that's so almost at a stroke, it changed or it reinforced the perceptions of millions of people. That is extraordinary journalism, and there is a war on that journalism.
All right.
Can I just say that you can see that clip of those journalists being killed in John Pilger's classic documentary, The War You Don't See, which is on his website, johnpilger.com, and now, along with his 60 other films, you can see at the British Library. Congratulations on that, John.
Beautiful.
Thank
John
you.
Pilger.
I mean, you mentioned The War You Don't See, Randy. The War You Don't See, the film I made in 2013, was basically interviews with quite distinguished mainstream journalists, broadcasters, reporters on both sides of the Atlantic, in the United States and in Britain. people like David Rose, formerly of The Guardian, Raggy Omar, formerly of the BBC, Dan Rather, formerly of CBS. And what their collective message was that had the media not colluded with government in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, had it not amplified and echoed the deceptions and lies of governments, then there is a great possibility that invasion, that war, would never have happened, and that all those people would be alive today. ISIS, which came out of the ruins of Iraq, might not exist. There might even be the beginnings of some kind of reconstruction, some kind of, dare I say, hope in the Middle East. But that, the part played by the media in that propaganda, had such a devastating impact that we should never forget it. And we shouldn't forget it when we're thinking about the present situation as our governments, Western governments, provoke Russia, provoke China, 400 bases ring China, right round China. You hear nothing of these, almost nothing of these in the press. Russia is in effect encircled. Unless people know about these incredibly important truths, nothing will be done. So this the Julian's plight, the episode in Salisbury, the extraordinary statements of say the British Foreign Secretary, who has become a kind of almost historical figure now, apart from an hysterical, but historical figure, in that he, in what he is saying, all of these are part of this propaganda campaign, which is at a critical stage. A critical stage, if war is provoked, then, well, we won't know, will we?
This is exactly where Julian Assange, the kind of structural reporting, if you will, and publishing in terms of the way these governments and these weapons folks are moving. That's the work he does. That's why they want him out of the way. John Pilger, we're out of time, but we hope Randy and I want to come back to you again and again to fight this fight until Julian Assange, one of our brothers in doing the work we all believe in, is still, we're going to do this until he's free. So we thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Dennis. My pleasure. Thank you, Randy.
Thank you.
All right. I'm Dennis Bernstein. That's Randy Credico. We are going to take a very short musical break, and we're going to continue this discussion with Christine Assange, longtime activist and a fighter for the freedom of her son, Julian Assange. Stay with us.
We will meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
And we're back, and we're joined now. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Randy Credico of Live on the Fly, coming out of New York City. And we're joined by Christine Assange. Let's just say she's somewhere in very far away in Australia. Christine Assange, it is Good to have you back again. Randy and I were hoping that this would be the occasion in which we would be celebrating and we'd have Julian on the other line, but that's not happening. You want to bring us up to speed as much as you know about where the situation is now and the kinds of details you think would help us to understand what's going on? And welcome back.
Thank you, Dennis. Thank you, Randy, for having me. And thank you for being good journalists and getting all this stuff out to the people. And a thank you to John Pilger, who's always great to listen to about the truth, and a wonderful supporter of Jill and a courageous investigative journalist. It's been noted that the courageous investigative journalists around the world are standing up for Julian. And like he said, the propaganda media, the fake news, are the ones pumping out the smear. Now, John mentioned that we're at a critical stage, possibly pre-war with Russia because of the propaganda lately around the Skripal poisoning in the UK, which has since been found not to be conclusively related to Russia, and all the diplomats being dispelled. Now, I would say we're also at a critical stage for Julian's safety and freedom. They're coming together and they are co-related. For example, just before Julian's complete communications with the outside world were cut off, the day before, one of the Lords in the UK Parliament stated, "Isn't it about time we took some action against the Ecuador embassy?" That he wasn't happy about Assange tweeting about the government response to the attack in Salisbury. Now, Julian was merely tweeting facts. And, of course, because Julian is known as a journalist who bravely tweets facts, that is very threatening. Truth is very threatening to corrupt power. And the next day, his communications are cut off. And, as I said, since then, what he said, his doubts about the... what the UK government narrative was have come to fruition, and the lab in Porton Downs has categorically stated there is no evidence to connect Russia with that Skripal attack. At the same time, what was happening at the same time is Julian was also invited to give evidence on Cambridge Analytica and Facebook. And the Facebook shares were down 20%. NASDAQ was down 3 to 5%, affecting the whole US market, the global market. So is it coincidence that also not only is he tweeting about the truth of the Skripal poisoning, but at the same time he's about to give evidence? And Cambridge Analytica, of course, has been tied into all sorts of dirty plays around trying to... defame politicians. At the same time, we've got major delegations from the US military and economic agencies going into Ecuador. And we've got no doubt whatsoever there's an incredible pressure on Ecuador to hand Julian over to the US. We know this because during the presidency of Rafael Correa, who gave Julian political asylum from US threats against his life and liberty, that it was revealed by the former US Ambassador Craig Murray, UK Ambassador Craig Murray, that the mainly Pentagon funds, up to $87 million, are being used to try and bring down Rafael Correa, which has now happened. He had to leave the party because he'd done his term, but now there's pressure on the new president, Lenin Moreno. And as far as although we were sort of hopeful with prior to Trump getting in with his We Love WikiLeaks, because WikiLeaks was publishing the truth about the corruption coming from the DNC and Hillary Clinton, of Can't We Just Drone Assange. But by April 2018, 2017, the US was firmly in a position of wanting to go after Julian. They were all on side. Mike Pompeo, April 13th, WikiLeaks is a non-state hostile intelligence service. He says, also says Julian Assange has no First Amendment freedoms. He is not a US citizen. Now, he's been promoted to from the CIA to the Secretary of State. Jeff Sessions around the same time, April. It's a priority to arrest Assange once and for all. You've got John Bolton, who has just been appointed National Security Advisor, who on March 8, 2017, suggested that the US government should launch a cyber war attack against WikiLeaks for revealing Clinton emails and the CIA hacking scandals. And looking back, President Trump in 2010 commented on WikiLeaks exposés. I think it's disgraceful. There should be like a death penalty or something. So there is no doubt that what is actually happening is that the US wants to shut Julian up. They want to shut him up about corruption, that their allies are cooperating, and that everybody is leaning on Ecuador.
Wow. That is the voice of Christine Assange. She's the mother of Julian Assange. She's a longtime activist. Now she's active in...
I'll just correct you with that one, Dennis.
Yes, please.
I'm not a longtime activist. Yes. I'm an accidental activist. That's an activist.
With a growing role in battling for your son's freedom as things intensify. And you have taken on... that role and done an amazing job. And I think those of us who believe in journalism and the free flow of information really can appreciate your struggle and want to know as much about it as we can. I mean, it is no surprise to Randy and I that there would be every move made to shut down Julian Assange right now in the context of what's going on with the Salisbury scandal and the way in which the Clinton machine has fanned this Russiagate flame and that crew really willing to risk World War III to prove that Hillary Clinton didn't lose the campaign because she was a horrifying candidate.
Yes, well, also, Julian was also very bravely, as a good journalist should, reporting factually on what was going on in Catalonia, which was absolutely disgraceful. I mean, you don't have to support either side, Spain or Catalonia, to be against the brutal crackdown of their democratic rights. And according to Ecuador, the reason they gave for cutting off all his communications, that's internet, phone and visitor access, because of one tweet, which was actually a factual tweet about the political prisoner, the elected president of Catalonia. He had previously been reporting factually where a lot of the world's media had taken the side of Spain. The word fascism is loosely used. I'm not happy with the way it's being used. It's used against everybody, but I think that we can say that the Spanish oppression of Catalonia can be seen as nothing more than the classical term of fascism, and that should be resisted worldwide in any country. And leaders of supposed free democracy should be standing up against this abuse.
I know. Randy is dying to jump in here. Randy?
Good morning. I know it's morning where you are, wherever you are. Christine, it's Randy Credico here. You were talking about Catalonia, the arrest by Germany of President Puigdemont of Catalonia, and Julian Assange did tweet something out. He was talking about that again, and, the Germans listened. Today they released Puigdemont, and they will not extradite him to Spain. And so he does have an effect. Thousands of people were protesting in Germany because of the arrest of Puigdemont, and they were embarrassed. And so this is the kind of journalism that they don't like. So I don't know if it's – here are three things that happened. That happened, that tweet. Also, he started talking about Salisbury. Dennis and I had Craig Murray on the show 2 weeks ago, and he was way ahead of his time on this. And Julian was talking about this. And then this guy, House of Lords, Sir Alan Duncan, comes out and says some nasty things and said he should be shut out. And so these things all happened within days, and then they cut him off. What is the connection there?
The connection is power, isn't it? The aligned power aligns. I mean, let's not mince words here. The struggle for freedom throughout the world in every country, for all of our ancestors, has been the struggle of people against corrupt power. That's what it is. And we're at a point now where we need the people power. I like a quote from 1984, George Orwell, that the hope, if there's any hope, it lies in the proles. That's us. That's the ordinary people. And throughout history, it's not been, generally speaking, it's not the leaders of our countries that actually ensure our rights. It's usually the leaders of the country that are preventing our rights and entrenching power. It's the people who stand up to the leaders, particularly in democracies where they can have some sort of a voice, and demand that their leaders act in their interests. And I think with this critical point in history, again, we're here, and we're always again defending liberty. It's a constant battle. The price of liberty is eternal vigilance, as one of the US prime ministers, I think, said, US president said. We're at this pivotal point in history, as John said, where we're facing a possible global war and at the same time a war on journalism, because obviously they don't want truthful journalism coming out and stopping any attempts at a nice, lucrative war for defence contractors. So I think we have to now step it up. The people have to step it up, because while petitions, well, we must sign these petitions. There are three that have gone to the president of Ecuador. One was actually delivered by
John Priolgo.
Signed or delivered by a group of ex-CIA, NSA, FBI officers supporting Julian. Another one was world leading thinkers, and we've got one started by the Landless Workers Movement in Brazil, which is a people-initiated 33 countries in the Spanish language live it. Now, those are important to sign those petitions, very important, all right? But it's also important to get involved in actions. And straight after the Julian was silenced, supporters all around the world, I don't know if you've covered this yet today because I couldn't listen in, but it was a 10-hour vigil, an internet vigil, under the Reconnect Julian hashtag, where truthful investigative journalists worldwide and people, free speech, human rights people, ordinary people, all joined together to put worldwide pressure to stop the US leaning on Ecuador to silence Julian.
Is that still going?
Now,
is that still on?
That's right. Well,
it resumes this week. It's an online vigil that resumes this week. I know that Susie Dawson is spearheading that, and I'm going to participate in that 48-hour online vigil coming this weekend. Last time you were on, Christine, you said to me and Dennis that we need WikiLeaks warriors, not WikiLeaks warriors. So how does that hardcore following of his maintain being warriors at this point?
Good question. All right, well, that vigil brought together various people from all around the world who'd individually been speaking up and supporting and defending Julian. They are now, and we're all now working together in a network to get up a global network for people, for the ordinary citizens who haven't yet been involved but are concerned for Julian's welfare and safety, to quickly access Assange Actions. And we've got up one, at the moment, just one Twitter handle, Assange Action, which will be mirrored in countries around the world. The Reconnect Julian hashtag and Unify for JA hashtag are also good inroads to where you can make contacts right now. But we will be building on this. And we need to take it to the streets. In the same way that any change happens in a country, it's the people going onto the streets telling their leaders that they're not going to vote for them if they continue down this path of suppressing the media, suppressing the people's right to the truth, abusing human rights of award-winning investigative journalists who give us the truth. Now, a good example of on-the-street actions are the historic long-term vigil outside the Ecuadorian embassy by UK citizens. It's been going for years, for nearly 6 years, rain, hail and snow. And people can visit that at any time they want. If you're in London, Three Hands Crescent, London, the Knightsbridge train on the Piccadilly line, just get out there, stand outside the Ecuadorian embassy with your placard. And there's official vigils that four times a week under the hashtag at JA_defence. It's next to Harrods. Now, that is something you can do that's already set up, okay? If you're in Australia, follow Assange, support Assange and WikiLeaks Coalition. Handle is at SAWC FID. It's FYD, or Sydney, I can't remember, it's FYD anyway. It's the Support Assange and WikiLeaks Coalition. That's already been up for years. Now, the thing is here, Andy, that there was a lot of activity worldwide right in defence of Julian and actions prior to him going into the Ecuadorian embassy because he was at imminent risk of extradition to the US via Sweden through their backdoor treaty of temporary surrender. And we're very grateful to Ecuador. Ecuador stepped up when none of the others would. They showed sovereignty, principles, ethics and courage in protecting Julian from the US. And this went on, you know, for several years. They were pressuring Ecuador, but they stood strong. Now, with the change of leadership and a problem in the government, the split in the party, they're now coming under extreme pressure and the Ecuadorian government appears to be wavering. This is critically dangerous for Julian. And because this has happened, now people around the world who are feeling, okay, well, he's safe, are now galvanising and organising actions.
30 seconds.
Yes. Do you have an outgoing message to
30 seconds.
To, President Lenin Moreno? If in 30 seconds, what is your message to him?
Stand up for sovereignty of your country. You've got a wonderful country, a fabulous constitution. It's a template for a world democracy throughout the world. Don't let down Ecuador. Don't let down Julian. Don't let down free press. Your constitution backs free press. Stand strong. The people will stand with you. Be remembered for the president who carried on the democracy in Ecuador, who stood strong and tall and didn't cave. You will be remembered for this. Don't be remembered for the president who rolled over for yet another U.S. coup of a South American country.
Perfect. We thank you, Christine Assange, Randy Credico in New York. I'm Dennis Bernstein. That wraps it up for another edition of important collaboration between Flashpoints and Live on the Fly with Randy Credico. Please stay tuned to Pacifica.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Have you ever argued with your parents, your teachers? Ever question majority opinions? Oppose the status quo? Of course you have. You're listening to KPFA. You're probably proud of being a dissenter. And you're supported in your pride by Charlene Nemeth. She's a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley, and she's going to be presenting her new book, In Defense of Troublemakers, The Power of Dissent in Life and Business, on Thursday, April 12th, 7:30 p.m. at the Hillside Club, 2286 Cedar Street in Berkeley. There is wheelchair access at this KPFA benefit. I'm Chris Welch, and I get to host this outspoken defender of dissent, Charlene Nemeth. Tickets are at independent booksellers and online at brownpapertickets.com. Join us, won't you? April 12th, the Hillside Club for KPFA. Support dissent.
KPFA, KPFB, Berkeley, 88.1.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. In the winter, a young man's fancy turns to thoughts of food, and so shall we today. We'll feature several short commentaries by Jim Hightower on the politics and the business of food. I hope you'll stay tuned. Thanksgiving has just passed, and Christmas is coming. And both American holidays have a focus on food. And food is the focus of our show today. In fact, I've been thinking about food for a lot of reasons. For one, Connecticut's annual harvest is now about over. At the farm stands, there's still a few local apples and a cabbage or two, but that's about it. Farmer Bissett, out in South Glastonbury, has added a few hogs to the produce he raises. Maybe a dozen pigs at the moment. These pigs lead an old-fashioned, real barnyard life. It's a far cry from the inhumane, insane, stinking conditions of the factory hog farms that produce 99% of the pork Americans eat. Sometimes, when I'm in the mood for a motorcycle ride, I'll putt over to the farm and see how the hogs are doing. And the laying hens, too, which are beautiful creatures. They are also free to roam about a bit. With luck, I'll also be able to chat with Farmer Bissett for a few minutes as well. Endangered species, all of them. Barnyard-raised chickens, barnyard-raised hogs, and family farmers. The hogs are scheduled to be slaughtered about now. To sell meat to the public, the animals must be slaughtered in a federally approved slaughterhouse. These are pretty scarce here in the Northeast. Bissett takes his hogs to New York State for slaughter. Next time I see them, they'll be cut into pieces, sealed in plastic, and frozen, all done at the slaughterhouse. Here's an irony. If you want fresh, locally raised meat, you almost always have to buy it frozen. I feel a little guilty at my lack of discomfort about eating Bissett's hogs. My lack of upset that these interesting, friendly creatures, whom I have met and spoken to, are going to be killed, chopped up, and eaten. Maybe it would be harder if I lived on the farm, if I fed the animals every day, came to tell one from another. Maybe I've become numbed by the incessant violence and brutality of the culture I live in. I don't mean video games and street crime. I mean the economic system that chews up and spits out workers. I mean a government foreign policy that consists mainly of war, war, and more war, and mostly war against civilians. Maybe I'm just so numbed by all of this by now that the death of a pig just doesn't engage me the way it did E.B. White. Of course, he raised the pig himself. A great essay, by the way, E.B. White's Death of a Pig, published in 1948. Give it a read if you've got the time, and your public library is still standing. Anyway, it's now early winter, and food is in the air, and our show today is on that very subject. We'll feature the old liberal rabble-rouser, Jim Hightower. Several times a week, Hightower releases a 2-minute commentary on U.S. politics and economics. Hightower's politics seem to be on the progressive end of the Democratic Party. I'm more impressed by commentators who are more radical than that. Give me some Noam Chomsky, Michael Peretti, Richard Wolff, Chris Hedges, Melissa Harris-Perry, and so on. But more mainstream liberals, like Jim Hightower, and like his fellow Texan, the late Molly Ivins, well, they have important things to say, too. Hightower is pretty good when he talks about food, agribusiness, and agricultural policy. Years back, when Texas had a liberal Democratic governor, Ann Richards, Hightower was state agricultural commissioner. So he's pretty well acquainted with both politics and agribusiness. Let's hear some Hightowerisms on the subject. We'll start out close to home, so to speak. Here's a piece on more marketing chicanery at the supermarket. A pet peeve of mine, too. That 1-pound box of spaghetti is now a 14.2-ounce box of spaghetti. And that 8-ounce can of tuna, for years, has been a 6-ounce can of tuna, and is now a 5-ounce can of tuna. And before we get to that, how about a paramilitary campaign that sacked an organic farm, courtesy of the drug war and the militarization of our local police forces? Here's Jim Hightower.
The Bible tells us that the Garden of Eden was heaven on earth until Adam ate that apple. Then all hell broke loose. Recently, hell erupted in the garden again, this time in Arlington, Texas, on a small organic farm named Garden of Eden. At about 7:30 in the morning of August 2nd, a SWAT team of armed police agents, code enforcement officers, and narcotics detectives suddenly exploded all over Shelley Smith's little farm. They burst through the gate, handcuffed the terrified residents, and held them at gunpoint while the agents executed the raid's mission. Which was what exactly? A City of Arlington spokeswoman explained that the purpose was to improve the quality of life and to resolve life safety issues within neighborhoods. It seems there had been complaints about marijuana being grown and about the place being unkempt. So, what did the derring-do raiders achieve? They captured 17 blackberry bushes, 15 okra plants, 14 tomatilla plants, some native grasses, and all the sunflowers. Then they whacked down Shelley's sweet potato patch with a weed eater and seized the farm's compost along with some wooden pallets, old tires, and furniture. Notice what they did not find? Marijuana plants, nor any other illegal products. In short, on the basis of rumor, autocratic police power was unleashed to improve the quality of life by destroying an organic farm. This is Jim Hightower saying, why would police resort to paramilitary force just to check out a few marijuana plants and some trash? Because right-wing officials and arms industry lobbyists have been pushing police departments all across America to switch from a peacekeeping approach to an aggressive, militarized SWAT mentality, with officers being armed, trained, and psyched to treat common citizens as enemies. To learn more, go to aclu.org/militarization. Mothers the world over have told their children a zillion times, stop playing with your food. I now share their frustration and would like to yell at the conglomerate packagers of America's victuals, stop playing with our food. Actually, they're playing with our heads, using dishonest packaging tactics to raise their prices without us noticing it. A 16-ounce carton of something, quietly slips to 14 ounces, but does not drop in price. Then there's the dimple trick. A jar of Hellman's mayonnaise, for example, has had its contents shrunk, yet the new jar looks as big as the old one, unless you turn it on its end. There, you'll find a big indention in the bottom, a hidden way to shrink the capacity of the jar and give you less for your money. David Siegel, who writes the Hagler column in the New York Times, recently reported on his adventures in Kraft Foods land. He talked to a PR lady there about the corporation's unpublicized but rather dramatic change in its Baker's brand of cooking chocolate. Instead of an 8-ounce package selling for $3.89, suddenly a box of Baker's contained only 4 ounces of chocolate, which sells for $2.89. Wow, that's nearly a 50% price hike per ounce. What gives? Siegel asked the Kraft spokeswoman. The change was consumer-driven, she craftily replied. Our consumers have told us that they prefer this smaller size. Sure, said Siegel, but what about that slippery price? She was as slippery as the price, declaring that the product is competitively priced. That was not the question, but her whole game is to avoid giving the honest answer. We're gouging our customers. This is Chum Hightower saying, conglomerate food packagers not only feel free to dupe us consumers, but also they're considering such corporate chicanery to be a legitimate business practice.
We've talked about slaughtering hogs. Now Hightower has a few words to say on slaughtering chickens. You've heard of the fox guarding the henhouse? Well, let's take this idea a step further. How about taking federal meat inspectors out of the huge corporate slaughterhouses and letting the big corporations inspect the factory themselves? Who would propose such an insane idea? The Koch brothers? Guess again. How about the administration of President Barack H. Obama?
An old country saying notes, you can't make chicken salad out of chicken manure. However, President Obama's Department of Agriculture intends for us to give it a try. Chicken contaminated with chicken manure is one likely result to come from the Ag Department's dangerous and ridiculous determination to privatize poultry inspection in some 200 processing plants across the country. Currently, government inspectors who are professionally trained in food safety are stationed along the processing lines in the factory operations of such giants as Tyson Foods. They examine the birds for diseases and visible defects, including, yes, contamination by feces. But the Obamacans have a modernization plan to remove these skilled independent inspectors and let corporations police their own lines with untrained company hirelings. In addition, the privatization scheme would allow the poultry plants to speed up their lines to an absurd 175 birds per minute. To justify this, USDA notes that it has been running a pilot project on privatization in 20 chicken factories since 1999. Yes, but the modernizers did not mention that salmonella rates in the privatized plants were higher than those having government inspectors. Just as alarming, of the poultry operations that failed the most recent salmonella tests, a disproportionate share were using the spiffy self-policing model. Worse, government inspectors who observe the corporate control system report that when company inspectors tried to be thorough about safety or even tried to remove diseased birds from the line, they were yelled at, reprimanded, and shunned. This is Jim Hightower saying, this senseless rush to privatize is literally sickening. For more information and clean food alternatives, go to Food and Water Watch at foodandwaterwatch.org.
Well, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and the salmonella is in the chicken, or maybe the burger. So let's turn our gaze from the slaughterhouse floor to the fast food restaurants that serve the meat. Here, though, Hightower isn't talking about contaminated meat, but underpaid workers and bad nutrition. Of course, underpaid workers can contaminate the food, too, especially when they are granted no sick leave. Here are four takes on the big business of fast food.
The failure of our corporate and political leaders to make sure every worker gets good health care is causing some unpleasant consequences, not just for them, but for all of us. Consequences like stomach flu. Ill workers often spread illness. This is because millions of employees who deal directly with the public as well as with co-workers are not covered by paid sick leave policies. So, when they come down with something like stomach flu, they still tend to drag themselves to work rather than going to bed until they recover, for staying home means a loss of pay or even loss of their jobs. Low-wage workers, such as those in the restaurant industry, are particularly vulnerable and, since they handle food, particularly threatening. Nearly 80% of America's food service workers receive no paid sick leave, and researchers have found that about half of them go to work ill because they fear losing their jobs if they don't. As a result, a study by the Centers for Disease Control finds that ill workers are causing as much as 80% of America's stomach flu outbreaks, which is one reason that CDC officials have declared our country's lack of paid sick leave to be a major public health threat. You'd think the industry itself would be horrified enough by this endangerment of its workforce and customers that it would either take the obvious curative step of providing the leave or of pushing in the name of public safety for a public sick leave program. But au contraire, amigos, such huge and hugely profitable chains as McDonald's, Red Lobster, and Taco Bell not only failed to provide such sensible care for their employees, but have lobbied furiously against city and state efforts to require paid sick days. This is Jim Hightower saying all top executives who never touch the food their chains serve get paid sick leave. For them to deny it to workers is idiotic, short-sighted, and even more sickening than stomach flu. At last, a fast food giant that gives a damn about the economic hardships faced by low-wage workers. Not only does McDonald's care, but by gollies, the good executives who sit atop the golden arches are goosing up the meager $8.25 an hour that their workers have been getting paid. As you can imagine, hair-netted hamburger flippers everywhere would be very grateful to see their hourly wage boosted to $10. Well, yes, but McDonald's didn't become a giant by paying fair wages. So actually raising the $8.25 wage is not the goose the executives are giving to their workers' paychecks. Rather, the burger chain has launched a website that instructs employees on how to stretch that $8.25 by better budgeting. "Plan ahead and save," exclaims McDonald's incredibly helpful website, adding that if each hourly worker would just organize personal financial records properly, he or she would, quote, become a better decision maker. Wow, low pay and a moral lecture. How great is that? Unfortunately, the website's suggested budget seems to have been written by Scrooge. Initially, the bean counters forgot to include a few essentials in the practical money skills budget they drew up for low-wage folks, like clothes, childcare, and food. Yes, a fat zero was budgeted for eating. Embarrassed, the clueless budgeteers threw in a little something for chow, but wait, their suggested monthly expenses total nearly $1,000 more than McDonald's pays its workers. Not to worry, though, for the budget helpfully assumes that each employee will have a second job to cover that shortfall in pay. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, McDonald's CEO draws $13.8 million a year, a take-home that makes budgeting unnecessary. But hourly employees could make that much, too, by working only 760 years for McDonald's. The appeal of fast food chains has not been their food, mostly fat, salty, sugary, empty-calorie blah, but their speed. Order, pay, and bam! Your warmed-over burger, pizza, chicken, taco delight is instantly handed to you. Yet, for a mega chain based on fast, McDonald's has proven to be embarrassingly slow, leaving it with flat sales and declining appeal. The executives in charge were so stuck on peddling obesity and diabetes for fat profits that they completely missed a mass shift in today's marketplace, the rise of health-conscious consumers. As a result, McDonald's has been losing out to Subway, Chipotle, Panera, and other chains that have been quick to cater to the lean and green customer base, particularly women and young buyers. But look out, for here comes the McDonald's marketing machine with a blur of ads and promotional gimmicks touting, quote, a new global commitment to make a world of difference. Using endearing pictures of children, the Big Mac chain now claims to be all about fresh veggies, fruit, salads, juices, milk, health, and a fuzzy happiness for all. The Golden Arches Empire has even signed up Bill Clinton to give its PR hype a sheen of sincerity. For an undisclosed splash of cash, the fast food marketer says it is now global partners with the Clinton Foundation to produce a healthier generation through its sales of more nutritious Happy Meals to the world's kiddos. However, the fast food giant is in no hurry to deliver on this pledge, claiming that getting healthier foods into its supply chain is a difficult and slow process. The CEO snickered that we don't go down to the grocery stores. This is Jim Hightower saying, well, maybe they should. Doing it the McDonald's way, he says, will take until 2020 to get the more nutritious stuff into all the stores of the chain's 20th largest markets.
The design of the galaxy is in the soil. Patterns are there, all very near. Look down, wisdom abounds. Soil grows the seed, bursts the flower, courts the bee, makes the honey. Honey is free. Soil anchors tree, hosts the nest, cradles the bird, offers song. Song is free. Honey we relish, bird song we cherish, and soil we must revere. The design of the heavens quite near. Soil holds the seed, grows the plant, feeds the body, lifts the breath. Breath is free. Soil houses life, fuels the web, awakens heart, stirs the dance. Dance is free. Breath we do cherish, dancing we relish, and soil we must revere. The design of the galaxy is in the soil. Answers are here, abundantly clear. Get down, wisdom abounds. The design of the galaxy is in the soil. The design of the galaxy is in the soil. The patterns are there, all very near, abundantly clear. Look down, wisdom abounds.
Let us all now bow before the God of free enterprise, whose awesomeness was revealed in a recent news release announcing that the divine managers of fast food demigod McDonald's achieved a profit of $1.5 billion in just 3 months this summer. Holy Big Mac! How did it do that? Peek behind the curtain and you'll see that McDonald's secret power is thee and me, America's taxpayers. The corporation rips off its huge workforce by paying poverty wages and no benefits, then directs the workers to the food stamp office and other government-funded safety net programs. Neat, huh? A major chunk of the chain's cost of doing business disappears from the corporate books and, shazam, reappears on the government's books. In fact, the National Employment Law Project reports that McDonald's phenomenal $1.5 billion profit is bloated by an estimated $1.2 billion that we taxpayers will shell out this year to support its predatory wage and benefit policy. Aren't you loving it, as the chain's ads say? But the Golden Arches are not alone in this fast food flim-flam. The conglomerate owner of Kentucky Fried Chicken, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell duns us for $648 million to underwrite its poverty pay. Subway burrows into us for $436 million. Burger King, a British outfit, taps us for $356 million. Little Sweet Wendy's grabs more than $250 million from us, and Dunkin' Donuts dips into our pockets for $274 million. And look here, it's Domino's Pizza, whose extremist right-wing owner says he hates government spending. But he's picking the taxpayers' pockets to the tune of $126 million to subsidize his free enterprise. This is Jim Hightower saying, the corporate powers preach about the magic of the marketplace, but magicians don't do magic. They perform illusions.
As you can hear, our focus is broadening up to the level of national economic policies. If full-time workers are paid so little that they are eligible for some government welfare benefits, then the taxpayers are subsidizing that employer's profits, in a roundabout way. But sometimes the subsidies are not roundabout at all, but direct. And, surprise, surprise, much of these farm subsidies go directly into the pockets of some very rich capitalists, including some very rich capitalists who have very little actual connection to farming. Meanwhile, the same farm bill that is giving your tax money to the rich is taking food stamps away from the poor and hungry. Is this enough to make you angry? Here again is Jim Hightower.
As we approach our annual Feast of Thanksgiving, please join me in expressing our nation's deepest, heartfelt feelings for an extra special group of America's farmers. That raspberry goes out to the 50 billionaires who've been farming the U.S. Farm Subsidy Program for years, harvesting a cornucopia of taxpayer cash for themselves or their corporate empires. The diligent watchdogs of the Environmental Working Group match their own farm subsidy database with the Forbes 400 list of richest Americans to unmask these Gucci-wearing old McDonald's. E-I-E-I-O, what a ripoff! Among the richest of these faux farmers are three Walmart heirs whose personal wealth totals $100 billion. Then there's investment huckster Charles Schwab, sitting on a $5 billion wad of wealth, yet pumping $500,000 worth of rice subsidies into his California duck hunting resort. Also, corporate takeover artist Henry Kravis, who has amassed some $5 billion in wealth, took more than $1 million from us to subsidize safflower, sunflower, and other crops raised on two of his ranches. Especially jarring is the presence of such multi-billionaire right-wingers as oil and entertainment tycoon Philip Anschutz and nuclear waste mogul Harold Simmons. They've expressed disdain for government spending on poor people and other, quote, takers, yet they've gladly taken more than $500,000 each in farm payments. Actually, the working group's tally understates the total haul by these mega-rich tillers of our public treasury. Many also harvest crop insurance subsidies, but Congress has dutifully outlawed disclosure of these names to the public, even though it's our money they receive. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fact, these billionaires' most profitable ag products are the Congress critters they keep in their corrals.
And with that, we bring our post-Thanksgiving food show to a close. The personal is the political, the saying goes, and you can't get much more personal than the food we eat. On the politics and economics of food, we heard 8 commentaries by Jim Hightower. You can hear and read more of Hightower at his website, www.jimhightower.com. And, of course, you can hear and read more from us at our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. That intriguing music we heard, "The Design of the Galaxy is in the Soil," was dug up by Virtual Renderings. Neither he nor I knows who sang it. If you happen to know, how about dropping me a line and filling me in? You'll find my email address displayed at the website, and once again, that is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. Thank you for listening. It'll get to my non-carborundum, and please eat with some care. And this week, I'll end on the same word, but I'll spell it differently. Not C-I-A-O, but rather C-H-O-W. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 Wake Up Call.
I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear whistleblower Sybil Edmonds, who has been gagged and classified by the U.S. government, share her story as a translator at the FBI and what she learned there about who's behind terrorism. And what you're about to hear comes from an April 2016 interview with the radio show host Tom Woods. It's episode 629, and you can find it at his website, tomwoods.com. I've edited parts of it here to fit into a 30-minute show. Sybil Edmonds is editor and publisher of Boiling Frogs Post. She's founder and president of the National Whistleblowers Coalition, and she's also behind a new effort at independent media called NewsBud, which you can learn more about at her website, boilingfrogspost.com. And here she is, Sybil Edmonds.
I began my work with the FBI 4 days after September 11, 2001, after the September 11 terrorist attacks, and I served two functions for the FBI's Washington field office, both as language specialist translator for three languages, but also that's Turkish, Farsi, and Azerbaijani. But I also performed analysis because of my background, political background, and knowledge of these countries that were the targets of certain investigations or the operatives from these nations. And that would be Iran and Turkey and several countries within Central Asia and Caucasus, including Azerbaijan, because they also speak various dialects of Turkish language. They are Turkic root languages. And let me just say that I never planned working for the government. I never wanted to work for the government, not only here, but anywhere else in the world. I grew up skeptical of governments, big governments. My father was a known surgeon in Iran. He was taken in and tortured for the kinds of books he was reading and handing out to people. I went through a military coup in Turkey in 1981, implemented by NATO and the United States. And we went through all the martial laws and the curfew. So I have lived in many countries to have this pretty good, strong desire to stay away from the government. The only reason I accepted the job offer, and they basically called and begged me because they said, our country, our nation needs you, Ms. Edmonds. We have had this attack and we are still under attack. There may be more attacks. And with you, we get 3-4 languages covered, plus your background and your analytical skills. I have a bachelor's degree. I have two of them in criminal psychology and criminal justice. I also have a master's degree in public policy. So all those kind of were, I guess, attractive to them. And I couldn't say no, because I was just like any other Americans out there. Well, they're telling me this is my chance to serve my country, and really my country, because other countries I lived in, I was either born in them or I lived them because my parents went from one country to another country for my dad's work. They were not by choice my country. The United States, I came here in 1988. I decided, consciously made a decision to become a citizen. So this is my first and only country by country of choice. And I became a citizen by choice, not because I was born into it. So I said, sure. And I was pretty naive. I was very green. I was similar to many Americans that I get to see or hear from. I totally believe what I was given through my education in the United States, master's in public policy. I love the fact that I was living in a country with separation of powers and constitution, bill of rights, the system of checks and balances. Little I knew. I had no idea that these were illusions that were being marketed and sold to the public through the education, academics, and the mainstream media, and of course, Hollywood. So I was one of the believers. I was very green. I believed that they didn't exist only in theory, but that they, in fact, applied. Well, As soon as I started working at the FBI, I came across some major cover-ups on extremely important investigations, not by choice by the agents, but because of the higher-ups in the State Department and people within the CIA, basically hindering the investigations taken by the FBI. In addition to that, I also witnessed incredible level of waste, fraud, abuse. I mean, things that if they were to really put it out there, and it should be out there, and I'm sure many people have tried to put it out there, and it's out there, that what the government does with people's trust and the tax dollars that they are cutting and collecting every month from their paychecks. And to me, that was an eye-opener, not only the cover-ups, but how these agencies were ran. And being an outsider, I was working for them as a contractor and someone who has always believed in the free market and efficiency. My husband and I, we've been married for 25 years. We have had our own business. It was surreal, the level of intentional waste, fraud, and abuse. And with the cover-ups and issues being significant, I tried to bring some of these issues to the attention of higher-ups within the FBI. Well, that was a major mistake because the problem actually was stemming from those higher-ups, the executive-level people. And that began a chain of reaction and retaliation. And then at that point, I said, well, based on what I studied, what I have a master's degree on, there are channels I can pursue. Yeah, I didn't go out there to media and leak documents. I believe there were appropriate channels, so it's my duty to take it to the Inspector General's office and have them look into these issues and do something about it. Well, the Inspector General's office for the FBI, DOJ, they work for the same bosses. So basically, you're going to the same people and asking them to investigate themselves. But hey, they said this is one of the so-called channels. I pursued it. That brought more retaliation. In fact, half a dozen or more agents stormed our house.
Here she's asked, what sort of information had she reported?
In some cases, there were significant, important facts related to counterintelligence investigations by the FBI that were stopped from being pursued via State Department and the CIA. Because the targets of those investigations actually had other working and operative relationship with individuals within the CIA and the State Department. So whether they were notorious criminals, let's say in movement of heroin into the United States from Afghanistan via Turkey and then Belgium, NATO's headquarters, and from there directly into the United States, or terrorism activities sponsored, strategically designed here in Chicago, in the United States, and then with the players being sent to areas in Central Asia, Caucasus, Middle East to execute terror attacks. These people didn't work for Al-Qaeda. They worked together with the CIA and a certain Pentagon units. These were the issues that would not be within the scope of what the FBI agreed. And you could not investigate and do anything about really true investigation of 9/11 without linking and getting linked to players within the United States. And on top of that chain, dealing with the CIA operations and certain Pentagon, joint Pentagon NATO operations overseas that were being handled from the United States. I know it sounds complex. I have received more gag orders than any other person in the history of this country. They invoked the state secrets privilege during John Ashcroft's Justice Department twice in my case. The Justice Department retroactively classified all investigations conducted by the United States Congress in my case. And this is after the United States Congress went publicly on record and they said all my reports and allegations were confirmed by other documents and other witnesses. But the Justice Department said, okay, now they're retroactively classified your results, the investigation results, and we impose gag order on you.
Here she's asked what the gag order prohibits her from saying.
In short, it means violating constitution and separation of powers because you can't have the executive branch, the Justice Department, issue gag order via retroactive classification on the other branch, legislative branch, the United States Congress. They basically said, you investigated, you said this, you're going to destroy all these documents, we are collecting everything in your computer, you cannot even refer to Sybelle Edmonds. Because under state secrets privilege, which they did via court, because I also went to court in this case, tried to get the case moving in court so I could bring in witnesses and expose all these massive cover-ups and the consequences of those cover-ups, and for the public's right to know, so the information, the truth would come out. And none of these were justifiably classified. It was not about some ongoing investigations. It was not anything that in any way could have been considered classified. They didn't want the public to know because that would have caused outrage. It would have exposed government's own illegality. Well, with Congress, even though illegal, this retroactive classification and gag order, they abided by it. And from both parties, I am not allowed to discuss the fact that there has been an ongoing operation and that involves CIA, NATO, and a certain division within Pentagon that implements, creates terror events at home and abroad, whether it's in Central Asia, whether it's by using Chechens, by training and arming them and having them blow up a building inside Russia, whether it is training and directing another group to blow up a certain entity within Turkey, that these operations are not done via what they advertise to be entities such as Al-Qaeda, or in this case, I'm sure it is what they call ISIL or ISIS. When you look at it, these entities, like in 19, my counterintelligence investigations that I was working on with three FBI agents, and these were field level agents, they were good people, these guys. The problem was from the higher ups and the State Department, the CIA. In 1997, for example, we had counterintelligence recording by tapping certain embassies, let's say if it's Turkish embassies, from 1997 records, that had Ayman al-Zawahiri of Al-Qaeda with two very well-known State Department officials, including Mark Grossman, and Prince Bandar meeting in Azerbaijan, in Baku, in an embassy, and on how to bring certain, what they call terrorist groups from Pakistan and from Saudi Arabia into Turkey, give them fake passports and funnel them into the Balkans area. And there for them to have training camps established and opening up mosques, building mosques. Okay. The financing of it partly came from the United States directly, partly from the Saudi Arabia, but also the operation included utilizing the opium grown in Afghanistan region and then processed in Turkey. Turkey is a NATO member, NATO ally country. And then from Turkey being distributed and traveling through Belgium, United Kingdom, and also in the United States. You're looking at terror activities committed by the United States government. You're looking at illegal narcotic operations being actually directed and operated by entities within the United States government. And yet, the stories being sold to the public being that there are these boogeymen in Afghanistan and there are these boogeymen Islamists in Saudi Arabia, they are independent actors who have come up together and they are terrorists and they hate the way of life we have here in the United States. And lo and behold, they are attacking our interests around the world and in our country. It basically, everything that we had in the FBI contradicted the story being told from the government, by the government to the media, and by the media being sold to the American public. That would be the summarized version of what it involved. Well, that's why the gag orders, the state secrets privilege, in courts, they came before the judges, the Justice Department and FBI attorneys, and they said, even if she's right, she can't talk about those because everything she knows is classified at the highest level. In fact, we want you, judge, and this was Judge Reggie Walton initially, and then it went to the appellate court and to the Supreme Court, Tom. We want you to declare her birthplace, where I was born, her birth date, the languages she speaks, where she has gone to school, like university degrees, all classified. And the judge approved it. The judge said, and this is the exact sentence he said, during these terror situations, who am I as a judge to disagree with the Justice Department and the FBI if they are telling me this will bolden terror and increase our terror, the threats of terror? Therefore, I'm going to grant. For us, my attorneys and I saying, how could you declare my birth date classified? If a police pulls me aside and says, you were speeding, driver's license, please. What am I going to say? I can't hand you my driver's license because it contains my birth date. It is that Kafkaesque. But the fact that these Kafkaesque authoritarian police state requests from the courts sail through the courts. So you had in federal courts, both at the appellate, later the Supreme Court level, for the judges to agree with it and saying, okay, yes, you can do that. Heck with the First Amendment. Heck with the due process. You can do that. The fact that the Congress can abide by an illegal gag order by the executive branch, well, that happened without any resistance from Senator Grassley, Senator Leahy. There were so many congressional people that they said, okay, if you order us, we'll do it. We're not going to argue with you. That tells you that neither our Bill of Rights nor these notions of checks and balances and the separation of powers really are at work or in practice. And if you were to challenge government's own criminality, whether it's criminal operations or covering up criminal operations, or it's fraud, waste, abuse with consequences borne by the American people, then there is no power above that government. And therefore, our Constitution Bill of Rights is conditional. It will get suspended if you are exposing government wrongdoing, because government is the ultimate power.
Here she's asked if she didn't just violate the gag order.
I have violating the gag order right and left, especially in the past 6-7 years with my book. We got a special order. It's already on the internet. Justice Department saying that they blacked out because I had to submit my manuscript for my book, Classified Woman. It's a nonfiction. So because of the contract I had signed with the FBI Justice Department, I was obligated to submit that to them. They had 1 month to review it and black out anything that was sensitive or classified. Well, they sat on it for 6 months or so, Tom, and they blacked out everything. They told my attorney every single word in that book is classified. She can't publish it. We are not going to release her from this order. She can't publish it. First of all, I went to publishers and I said, because I know I did not put anything that was justifiably classified, because I know what is classified, what is not. And second, this is against Constitution and First Amendment. The publishers, all these major publishers, they said, unless FBI gave its blessing, they were not going to publish, because then the FBI was going to go after them. So I had to hire my own team, my own editor, my own book cover designer, and the fact checker, and get this book produced and self-publish it via Amazon. And this is after the written letter forbidding me, the government forbidding me from publishing. They didn't do anything. Maybe it was this bluff, who's going to blink first? Maybe the government is so used to federal government by issuing the threat for people just backing off. They thought that was going to be the case. Maybe they thought if they were to take me to court, it was going to bring more publicity for the book and the case and the issue. We are not sure exactly the reason, but I guess they knew with the mainstream media under their control, so there won't be any publicity, any reviews of the book in anything mainstream as far as the media is concerned. It would go away. How many Americans are going to know about FBI whistleblower from 14 years ago or at the time 12 years ago? And maybe they were right. But regardless, I guess standing your ground and saying constitutionally they're wrong, you know, morally they're wrong, and I am not going to back off. And it's my right to publish it, and it's the public's right to read it. And I guess if enough Americans were to do that, whether they are government employees or whether they are just ordinary citizens, we wouldn't be in this position we are today. Unfortunately, that is not the case, because whether with the TSA abuses or with the NSA abuses or with the tortures and black sites, since really most people, they do not dare to stand up or challenge or do anything. We are seeing only the escalations of these police state practices, and things every day is getting worse.
And here she's asked that as an FBI translator, how she had access to all of this information.
Well, not only that my work involved in the FBI with these agents, one of or several important ongoing counterintelligence operations that dated back to 1996. And I performed analysis for them because they didn't have any analysts within the FBI or Justice Department who was both language specialist, knowing the language, plus having the political background of these involved nations or players, which my background did. But also, after the whistleblower journey began for me, the retaliations, polygraph, confiscating my computers, the court cases, I formed my own National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, and I have about close to 200 whistleblowers from the FBI and the CIA and the DIA and all these intelligence law enforcement agencies. And also, I have worked with people who later retired from the FBI on some of these issues, not only on my case, but on related cases as well. But also, the political knowledge that comes with my background includes certain operations that were conducted, you know, directed by the United States, but conducted in places where I lived, including Turkey. And again, in many ways, it's different here in the United States. In a way, we are so isolated. When you are in Europe or in Middle East, you get to see many of these operations and policies actually in action. And even though in some of these, you know, all of these third world countries, everybody recognizes them as authoritarian, you know, under dictatorship. I consider, because having the experiences living in those countries, coming from living in those countries, and here for the past 28 years, that the situation of authoritarianism and police state practices is actually much worse here than it is in the worst dictatorship. And here's why. In those countries, there is no doubt in the minds of the public, okay, that they are living under dictatorship. I mean, you talk to 99% of the people will tell you that they are living under authoritarian police states and that they have no rights and no democracy, all that. It's worse here because here with the illusion, you get most people, the majority, still saying, yeah, things are not perfect, but we are far from being, you know, police state or fascism, etc. And that makes it that much more dangerous here because there is this denial here. There is, and as long as you have denial, you do not have any possibility, any chance for changing things, for throwing things away and building something new or any kind of standing up because there is that denial factor. In those countries, they have better chance, even though they get influenced by outside big countries, than we do here in the United States because people, they don't want to accept. They are in denial or they are just honestly naive like I used to be, saying that sure, there's some corruption here and there, but we are the best. There is no other country as free as we are. And we do have, and then we celebrate our 4th of July and we eat our hot dogs, we drink beer, we have the firework and we declare ourselves as a nation of free where the fact, where the reality is far from it. Thus, rendering us in a more precarious, dangerous situation than those third world countries with already publicly acknowledged authoritarian regimes.
And now here she's asked about how to get people to believe in what she's saying about who's actually sponsoring the terrorists.
They would say it is impossible. Again, it comes, again, thanks to the mainstream media, maybe resistance by the people to actually even delve into history and context. That is not something new. Operation Gladio began right after World War II, and it is not a conspiracy theory. If you were to go and type it, it was a NATO, US, and UK ran operation that said, okay, in order to counter the communism and Soviet Union, okay, and what we're going to do is we're going to create these false flag terror events in Turkey. And if you go to the list, these are confirmed lists. CIA's FOIA, after 40 years, have already put this information out. You will see these terror incidents in Italy, okay, that was conducted by the U.S. NATO forces, and then that was blamed on some communist faction in Italy or the Soviet Union. You go and look at Bulgaria and you see what happened there. You will go and see in Turkey. So these false flag operations, they're already confirmed. So what happened, Tom, is after the fall of the Soviet Union, that operation started shifting starting in 1995. And that's the counterintelligence operations I was working with the FBI agents in this specific, very contained unit within FBI's Washington field office. Around 1995, 1996, the original Operation Gladio, which I refer to Gladio A, shifted to Gladio B. Now, instead of having creating these false synthetic terror events for the long-term objectives of the powers, the Western powers, and blaming it on the communism with the Soviet Union gone, it was going to be blamed on the Islamists. And that was going to pave the way, not only our way into the Middle East, but mostly, and this is again something nobody wants to pay attention or even know about here in this country, with the main targets being Central Asia and Caucasus. Saudi Arabia oil is not going to be here in another 10, 15 years. The long-term objective has been Eurasia. It's been all these natural gas-rich, mineral-rich, oil-rich nations surrounding Russia, whether you're looking at Kazakhstan or Turkmenistan or Azerbaijan. So, for example, let me give you a quick example to you. In 1997, because my counterintelligence unit also involved a lot of operatives and people from Turkey, Turkish being my primary main language, there was this mullah, this imam, this extremist Islamist guy named Fethullah Gulen, okay? Fethullah Gulen was preaching and wanting to bring Sharia law, and Turkey, even though they had elections, they were still, and they are still, under the military regime since the coup in 1981. So they decided to jail this guy. Mysteriously, Fethullah Gulen got into a Gulfstream jet, CIA-owned, in 1997, and he was brought into Washington, D.C., okay? And worked with the State Department and worked with the State Department's other puppet. And this is the guy they declared the United States State Department, the president in absentia of Turkestan, which is the Xinjiang region in China. So basically they said, this guy is a president. He's the Washington, D.C., but because the objectives also include Xinjiang area, and this is again Turkic faction living in that portion of China, which sits on this very important pipeline for gas and oil. And by 1998, this man, this Imam Mullah from Turkey, Fethullah Gulen, began his NGO organization under moderate Islam here in Washington, D.C. and in Pennsylvania, okay? And right now, if he's still here, okay, if you go and put Fethullah Gulen NGO organization, it will give you the value of this organization in terms of financial power at $22+ billion. He owns the largest charter school groups in the United States. Well, our operatives from the CIA and State Department, under his name, with him, they began establishing more than 350 mosques in places like Azerbaijan and Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. Now, nobody knows where this guy is bringing his $22 billion. Nobody knows about the source of this, which goes to the heroin operation that is conducted by U.S. NATO via their proxy nation, Turkey, through Turkey. Now, those labs to process those poppies moved from Turkey to Azerbaijan. Currently, a lot of those labs are in Azerbaijan, and now they are able to do it in the source, which is Afghanistan, but they couldn't do that 15, 18 years ago. Fethullah Gulen is not a conspiracy theory. People can go. He's a Turkish mullah. He is worth $22 billion. He's the man. If they go and look at the number of mosques, by now it's about 380 plus mosques that we, together with Fethullah Gulen, we, the United States State Department and CIA, have established all over the Central Asia and Caucasus. Some of these mosques, their grounds were used for training Chechens, okay? And getting these Chechen fighters in mid-1990s into Balkan during our Balkan Wars. Some of these Chechen we used to send them into Russia to execute terror attacks. Well, some of these same Chechens now with ISIL, those same Chechens are being sent, have been sent into Syria and in Iraq. If you go and look at the roots of the Chechen terrorism, well, we did it with this mullah. We have been doing it, Mullah Fethullah Gulen, in all this region starting in mid-1990s under Operation Gladio B. And it, the documentation in terms of what this man has been doing, he's like an 82-year-old man. He only went through third grade education. He's has semi-Alzheimer's, okay? He's sitting in this castle in Pennsylvania. It's a major castle, and the compound is protected by all these mercenaries and with helicopter security. And this man owns and operates the largest charter school chain in the United States of America. And he is, as far as the reach is concerned in terms of building mosques and training terrorist grounds, this man is much bigger than entire operations conducted by Saudi Arabia under our guidance. But nobody will talk about that in the U.S. mainstream media, even though the facts for it is out there for everyone to see.
And again, you were just listening to FBI translator and whistleblower Sibel Edmonds. From an April 2016 interview on the Tom Woods radio show, she has written two books, Classified Woman and Lone Gladio. Her website is boilingfrogspost.com. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
And this is Building Bridges with Kanesh and Mimi Rosenberg.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. Where do we go from here? Rekindling the revolutionary King's ideas and the activism that followed on this 50th anniversary since his martyrdom. We are speaking with Claiborne Carson, who is a professor at Stanford University, a history professor and director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute, which edits and publishes Dr. King's papers, and is indeed the foremost scholar in the country looking at the works and legacy of Martin Luther King. And Michael Honey, historian and author as well of the just released To the Promised Land, Martin Luther King and the Fight for Economic Justice, and of course the acclaimed book before that, Going Down Jericho Road, The Memphis Strike, Martin Luther King's Last Campaign, the issue of really the whole King, a man of civil and human rights, but understood the imperative to intermesh that with economic justice and made that a fight of his life as well. And Michael, we are speaking to you now on this 50th anniversary of the assassination of King from the Lorraine Motel. So welcome. Yeah. And
sitting in the Lorraine Motel in one of the staff offices, just a great moment. People are pouring into Memphis from all over the place. This morning I was at Mason Temple. American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees are having a two-day conference there called IM 2018. They're bringing people from all over, and the purpose is to use the memory of this event 50 years later as a way to rekindle movements for social justice and particularly economic justice. From a worker's point of view, but also they're very concerned about mobilizing people for the 2018 elections to try to remove some of the reactionary forces that are dominating Congress. So it's a two-pronged thing, and it's going to get bigger tomorrow. And then here at the previous Lorraine Motel, which is now the National Civil Rights Museum, there's 3 days of activities 50 years since King. So I call this the bonds of memory, that it makes a difference how people remember. So my work, as Dr. Carson knows, is really about the economic justice issues. And in the book that I just published, To the Promised Land, Martin Luther King and the Fight for Economic Justice, I start there with slavery. And when I started working on this book, I was sort of surprised. I sort of knew it, but I really started pinning it down, and it was almost surprising to me how much he talked about slavery. And of course, his great-grandparents were slaves, some of them. His grandparents were sharecroppers, lived under the cruel segregation, which was slavery by another name, as King said, and was born in 1929 at the beginning of the Great Depression, lived in an area of Atlanta that was very poor. And so our idea of King, you know, in a suit and tie at the March on Washington, sort of the way the media has portrayed him through the years, and particularly back then, was this is a civil rights advocate. And James Lawson, who's a great informative person on all of this, says you have to first understand the social gospel, and second, that he's a nonviolence advocate. And once you're a nonviolence advocate, that covers everything. It covers war, covers poverty, economic injustice. It certainly covers what happened here in Memphis with 1,300 men out on strike for the right to a living wage. 40% of them lived below poverty. They could be fired at any time. They had no rights on the job whatsoever. They weren't recognized by the city, even though they had organized a union. And two men were killed on February 1st that should never have been killed. It was faulty equipment that the union had demanded over and over again to replace. And that was kind of the thing that pushed it over on February 12th. It was sort of like the Montgomery bus boycott. The workers met. There's 1,300 black workers in sanitation. They met the night before at a labor temple, and they decided not to go on strike. They decided, we're not going back to work. This is intolerable. It was against the law for them to strike as public employees, even though they had no rights as union members. But it was sort of like the Montgomery bus boycott, where they waited Monday morning to see if anybody, you know, rode on the buses, and lo and behold, nobody did. And on Monday morning in Memphis in 1968, on February 12th, people looked to see, is anybody riding on the garbage trucks? Is anybody working? No, they weren't. That strike went on for about 2 months, and the men there were heroic. A lot of the story about King is the story of working class and poor people, including during the Montgomery bus boycott. 80% of those people were women who rode the buses. In the South at that time, almost everybody had so-called unskilled jobs, low-paid jobs. These were the people that made up the civil rights movement. So we get this image of King as the PhD, the very articulate leader, who could come in and bring some great insights into the movement. And that's what he did in Memphis. But we don't think about what's the background for King. And Dr. Carson has talked about that. He was a labor advocate from the very beginning. And so this was not new, but it's not something that people think about. They don't think about the March on Washington being the march for jobs and freedom. It was always part of the framework. He said civil rights and voting rights were phase one so that we would have rights to fight with. Now we want to open up the system for, as I was hearing Clay say, a moral revolution, a change in the socioeconomic system. That's a lot.
Sorry. Claiborne, do you want to join in with this also?
My own feeling is that if we wanted to map what's happening now on the history of what is usually called the civil rights movement, we're at an early stage of it. You know, I look upon what's happening as kind of the late 50s, early 60s, you know, where you have these movements popping up, Montgomery back then and the sit-ins and, you know, different cities. And that's what I see happening with Black Lives Matter. I see that happening with protests about different kinds of issues, mass incarceration and things like that. But we're only beginning to develop a sense that this is one big movement. There's still very few people who are seeing the connections between the immigrant rights work that needs to be done and an issue like Black Lives Matter. But there are ways of connecting these. And once you begin to connect it, it becomes a stronger movement. And that's what happened in the 1960s. And that's what King was best at articulating. Because he was a visionary, he was able to see that there were these triple evils in the world, and they were interrelated. If you take on one, you have to take on the other to be effective. And furthermore, these are global issues. They're not likely to solve the problem of poverty in one country. Once you do, then everyone wants to move there who's poor someplace else. That's what's happening in so many ways. In the poor countries of the world, everyone wants a visa to come to Europe or the United States or Canada or someplace that is wealthier. Well, that doesn't really solve the basic problems, because once they get here, there's still poverty. So I think King was one of those who was kind of a theorist of globalism before we even used that term. He was aware that certainly we can't solve the problem of war, we can't solve the problem of poverty, and we can't really build a strong political movement as long as external fears divide people. That happened during the Cold War. The Cold War suppressed debate about political alternatives. That took some of the greatest freedom fighters out of the picture because they were silenced, like people like Paul Robeson and Du Bois. And I think that right now we have to have this dialogue across these boundaries, because a lot of energy is being developed. We see a million people in Washington over the single issue of gun violence in schools. But how are those people going to translate that into a movement for political power? How are those million people going to relate to the issue of guns, say, militarization of the police, mass incarceration? I can see the connections, but I wonder if they can. Without that, it's likely that you'll get these piecemeal reforms that might deal with the peripheries of issues without understanding that guns are simply a symbol of the overall militarization of American society. Glorification of war, the emphasis on military expenditures. Where do these guns come from in the first place? How do people develop a fascination with them, with military assault weapons? Now, these are the kinds of questions that I'm hoping that the million people who came to Washington will begin to think about. And hopefully over the next decade, we'll see if that gets translated into a political change. We have not had a single election in the last 50 years where white Americans and black Americans have voted for the same candidates. We've got to cross that bridge and begin to develop a movement that can pull the two political parties to the left rather than to the right.
And Mike Honey, in response to Dr. Carson, your thoughts on this and your thoughts to how King informs the discussions today. And I can't help but think about the sanitation strike, particularly in relationship to the Janus case, which is before the Supreme Court, and the really decimation and disrespect of the public sector workforce, which kind of takes me back to Memphis.
Yeah, we're at a very dangerous point. Dr. King came to Memphis at a time when public employees in many states did not have the right to even unionize or pay union dues. So Tennessee was one of those states. They call it right to work, but it's really right to work without a union. The Janus case, that plaintiff is saying that not only does he not have to belong to a union, which the courts, I think, have pretty much said you don't have to belong to a union, but in addition, if the union is representing you for wages, hours, and conditions, also, I'm not going to pay any union dues. Even if they divide the dues up into some of it's for political donations, okay, you don't have to pay that part of it. But if somebody's representing you, somebody has to pay for that person. And that was the key point in the Memphis sanitation strike. Henry Loeb, the mayor of Memphis, he said, you can have a union, but I won't recognize it. I won't sign a contract. And no way will you deduct union dues from your paycheck. And of course, he knew that kills the union, particularly with very poor people. They don't have money in their pockets to pay to a union organizer. If you have a union, you can raise the wages. King said a union is the best anti-poverty program for somebody who works. You can raise your wages, get better conditions, and the sanitation workers did all of those things once they won their strike, and then get dues deduction so that your union can function. No organization can function without any funds. That's the key thing that we're looking at now. And after the Memphis sanitation strike, Jesse Epps said Memphis was either the gate or the exit. You know, that if you couldn't win in Memphis, despite the union pouring everything it had basically into this fight, then you wouldn't be able to win anyplace else in the South. You know, it was horrible that Dr. King was killed here, but when I interviewed black workers for this book called Black Workers Remember, said, yes, it was a terrible thing, but King knew that everywhere he went, that he was in the crosshairs of various people trying to kill him. He could have been killed in various places, but he knew that fighting for the rights of these sanitation workers was worth putting his life on the line. And so, remember, we won that strike, and AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, became the fastest growing union in the country and has been for the last 50 years. And so this is what they're trying to stop. with the right, so-called right-to-work laws. And Dr. King said he opposed those laws when they were trying to pass them in various states. They provide no rights and they provide no work. So don't go along with this rhetoric. And the Koch brothers and the business forces on the right, the Chamber of Commerce, they love this. It's a non-union environment. That's what they're after. So in Memphis, we're talking about 50 years since King, what's happened economically. One of the things that's very clear from all the statistics about Memphis is that the workforce has changed. The big factories have closed. Those were the big unionized workforces. Once upon a time, about 20% of workers in Memphis belonged to unions. That's all been pretty much destroyed by deindustrialization and so-called globalization. But the jobs have expanded dramatically in healthcare and social services and all kinds of services, including people who are better educated, college educated, and so forth, but they don't have unions. And so people wonder why, when the economy is expanding and profits are shooting through the roof for quite a few years now, that wages are stagnant. Well, who's going to push those wages up if you don't have a union? And if you don't do something about that, you're not going to be able to alleviate poverty. And Memphis is a great case study of that. But so is the whole country. You know, we had 40 million poor people when Dr. King was here, and now we still have 40 million poor people. And a lot of them are workers that have been knocked out of the economy by mechanization or globalization, and the working poor who have jobs, but they're not making a living income. So the Memphis story for AFSCME and these other unions and the fight for 15 people provides a narrative about, you know, this is what we need to do. This is what Dr. King said we need to do. It's one aspect. Like Clay said, it's a whole huge set of issues that are all interrelated. But one aspect of it is fighting for the rights of workers and increasing wages. And it's not going to happen from the government. It's going to happen to happen from the people fighting for these things.
Michael, I think it's also important for people to realize that the new economy of the 21st century creates a sense of isolation of workers so that you feel that you are working as one person rather than a group. As you mentioned, factories have closed down. We don't have a lot of that anymore. We have a gig economy where everyone negotiates individually with their employer. There's no sense of commonality with other workers. In fact, there's a sense of almost competition with other workers. You know, for example, when I drove a taxi, I was a member of a union back in my college days. Now, if you work for Uber or Lyft or any of those places, you're considered an individual contractor. You provide your own car, your own insurance, and you're out there competing with every other driver. It's an economy designed to make every other worker your competition rather than a potential ally. It's going to be a long, hard struggle because that has become entrenched. The privatization of many jobs have made it more and more difficult for people to organize in any effective way. So
one of the things that Dr. King brought out that I think we could return to is this idea about changing the values of America, the priorities of America. Part of that is the simple idea of solidarity and overcoming this isolation, as you're talking about. The system is designed to keep us from having solidarity. So organizations are trying to find ways around that. So the Fight for 15, for example, is trying to organize fast food workers, realizing they'll probably not get a union. But if we put enough pressure, picket lines, public things, so we don't have the power of a union, but we have the power of organization and public pressure, then it's possible to get back to that idea of solidarity. And I think that goes across the board. Dr. King said it very simply on March 18th in Memphis in 1968, we can all get more together than we can get separately. And this is a moral position, of course. But it's also a very functional economic framework, and also for building these broad coalitions that Dr. Carson's talking about.
I'm particularly interested in what strikes you about and what came together for the really the last campaign of King, which actually was more of his campaign rather than joining in other grassroots activism that was going on throughout the South. And that's the Poor People's Campaign, which placed the demand for housing and health care and education and jobs or adequate income for all. Your thoughts, both of you, on the significance of that effort. And we should mention that we've certainly had on the Reverend William Barber, who seems to have inherited that mantle and is carrying forth the Poor People's Campaign, which we hope certainly builds to a national movement. But Mike Honey, Claiborne Carson?
One of the things that King, there's a great quote in this new book. He said, "I'm not just concerned about the African-American poor. I'm concerned about the white poor. I'm concerned about the Latino poor. I'm concerned about the Puerto Rican poor. I'm concerned about the Native American poor. I'm concerned about poor people in general, and it's global." So, you know, we're certainly at a time when I think that kind of talk and framework is so appropriate.
Civil rights gains in the 1960s has made us very complacent about our losses in other areas. The sign of unionization is very important. The rise of the union move brought us the expectation of things like pensions and health care plans that were for large numbers of workers. In the decline of unions, we see so many people outside of any of these protections. Every worker is responsible for taking care of their own health care, taking care of their own pension. And that's very difficult to do when you're at the bottom of the economic structure anyway. It'd be good if we at least were moving toward a society where we have national health care, in which we have a strong social security system. But we see even these kinds of gains that we had earlier being destroyed in the 21st century. I mean, who would have thought that we would be going downhill? We have more and more people who are just marginal in terms of the economy. Trying to organize them is going to be tough. You know, if sanitation workers who had no protections could finally reach the point of desperation when they knew that they had to join together, I think that's where we are as a nation and maybe as a world. A lot of people are at that point of desperation. That can drive you in two different directions. You know, you can direct your resentment upward, and that's difficult, or you can direct your resentment towards people who are even more oppressed than you are because you see them as competition. I fear the latter. From the last election return, that's what's obviously happening with many white workers, is that rather than understanding that they are getting clobbered from above, they turn their resentment on those who are even less fortunate. We live in a very difficult time, and I'm hopeful because I think young people are beginning to understand that.
Clayton Carson, if you can just tell us, we're going to hear a piece from Dr. King now, and I wonder if you can just quickly set it up for us.
The recording is from King's Nobel Prize lecture. This was in December of 1964, at a time when Martin Luther King was beginning to lay out his broader agenda. The Civil Rights Act of 64 had been passed, and he used this as an occasion to focus on the three issues that he had already laid out in his letter to Coretta back in 1952, where he also laid out three similar concerns, and basically saying that I'm moving beyond simply the race issue and getting to focus on the global issues of poverty and war. So I think in this speech, you can clearly understand the direction he was moving at the end of 1964.
Let's listen.
The problem of spiritual and moral lag, which constitutes modern man's chief dilemma, expresses itself in three larger problems. Each of these problems, while appearing to be separate, is inextricably bound to the other. I refer to racial injustice, poverty, and war. The struggle to eliminate the evil of racial injustice constitutes one of the major struggles of our time. The present upsurge of the Negro people of the United States grows out of a deep and passionate determination to make freedom and equality a reality here and now. What is happening in the United States today is a relatively small part of a world development. What we are seeing now is a freedom explosion. The deep rumbling of discontent that we hear today is the thunder of disinherited masses rising from dungeons of oppression to the bright hills of freedom. In one majestic chorus, the rising masses are singing in the words of our freedom song, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn us around." The era of colonialism is at an end. East is meeting West. The earth is being redistributed. Yet something within has reminded the Negro of his birthright of freedom. And something without has reminded him that it can be gained. And with his black brothers of Africa and his brown and yellow brothers in Asia, South America, and the Caribbean, the United States Negro is moving with a sense of great urgency toward the promised land of racial justice. A second evil which plagues the modern world is that of poverty. It projects its nagging, prehensile tentacles in lands and villages all over the world. Almost two-thirds of the peoples of the world go to bed hungry at night. They are undernourished, ill-housed, and shabbily clad. Many of them have no houses or beds to sleep in. Their only beds are the sidewalks of the cities and the dusty roads of the villages. Most of these poverty-stricken children of God have never seen a physician or a dentist. This problem of poverty is not only seen in the class division between the highly developed industrial nations and the so-called underdeveloped nations. It is seen in the great economic gaps within the rich nations themselves. Take my own country, for example. We have developed the greatest system of production that history has ever known. We have become the richest nation in the world, yet at least one-fifth of our fellow citizens, comprising about 40 million individuals, are bound to a miserable culture of poverty. The poor in America know that they live in the richest nation in the world, and that even though they are perishing on a lonely island of poverty, they are surrounded by the vast ocean of material prosperity. If man is to redeem his spiritual and moral lag, he must go all out to bridge the social and economic gulf between the haves and the have-nots of the world. Poverty is one of the most urgent items on the agenda of modern life. Why should there be hunger and privation in any land, in any city, at any table, when man has the resources and the scientific know-how to provide all mankind with the basic necessities of life? Just as nonviolence exposed the ugliness of racial injustice, so must the infection and sickness of poverty be exposed and healed, not only its symptoms, but its basic causes. This too will be a fierce struggle, but we must not be afraid to pursue the remedy, no matter how formidable the task. The time has come for an all-out war against poverty.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King speaking shortly after he received the Nobel Peace Prize.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
On its way, the march stopped outside Prime Minister Thatcher's residence in Downing Street.
I grew up black. I've been discriminated against all my life. For somebody to discriminate against me because I'm gay is a joke.
People assume that as a feminist, I'm going to do a lot of anti-male humor. I don't really know him that well to make jokes about him.
When people see people who are fearless coming, they get out of the way.
I went back to having mutual oral sex with this man. And then all of a sudden I looked up the door and there was this officer standing in my bedroom door.
Where will you be when they come?
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell.
And I'm Greg Gordon. Conservative Croatians counter gender treaty compliance.
Gay Connecticut justice denied top court spot.
And the queer world as it was in 1988.
All that and more this week because you've tuned in to the 30th anniversary edition of This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 31st, 2018. Thousands of demonstrators in the Croatian capital of Zagreb have protested their country's joining an international treaty intended to protect women from domestic violence. The March 24th demonstration was organized by Croatia's conservative opposition and the Roman Catholic Church, which has a strong influence on the daily life of most of the nation's 4.2 million people. Almost 90% claim membership in the church. Top Croatian clergy issued harsh warnings before the protest, which drew an estimated 10,000 people, asserting that anyone who supports what's known as the Istanbul Convention should no longer be considered a believer. The treaty, which has been signed by 46 nations, as well as the entire European Union, defines gender as the socially constructed roles, behaviors, activities, and attributes that a given society considers appropriate for women and men. Opponents claim that the document introduces a third gender into society and opens the door to marriage equality and expanded legal rights for transgender people. Croatia joined the European Union in 2013, 2 years after the Council of Europe adopted the convention. Even though the center-right coalition government finally approved joining the treaty last week, it has yet to be ratified by Croatia's parliament.
The Republican-dominated Connecticut Senate this week rejected the elevation by Democratic Governor Dan Malloy of current Associate Justice Andrew McDonald to Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court. McDonald would have become the first openly gay state Supreme Court Chief Justice in U.S. history. Malloy charged that McDonald's confirmation failed for political reasons, including McDonald being openly gay. GOP leaders countered that he was rejected in part because he's seen as what they called an activist jurist. Senator Beth Bayh, a Democrat from West Hartford, wondered aloud, however, why McDonald could be considered qualified to be an associate justice but not chief justice, since each has just one vote on any given case. "That dog just won't hunt," she said. McDonald will remain an Associate Justice of the Connecticut Supreme Court. He has 3 more years left on his 8-year appointment.
A 4-3 decision by the Louisiana Supreme Court this week let stand a lower court ruling that overturned an executive order by the governor that had banned bias against LGBT people in state government. An appeals court decided that the April 2016 edict by Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards was an unconstitutional effort to expand state law. 4 of the High Court justices rejected the case without comment. Of the three justices who dissented, two indicated that they wanted the High Court to review the case but gave no specific reasons. In her dissent, Chief Justice Burnett J. Johnson argued that the High Court's majority held an unreasonably restrictive view of the governor's authority. She believed the anti-bias order to be within his executive powers. "I am dismayed," she added, "that Louisiana finds itself yet again on the wrong side of history in a matter of civil rights and social justice."
In other news, a screening of the Academy Award-winning Call Me By Your Name has been pulled from the Beijing International Film Festival. The movie's distributor, Sony Pictures Entertainment, announced the action this week without explanation. The film, which won a Best Adapted Screenplay Oscar this year for openly gay screenwriter James Ivory, follows the budding romance between a 17-year-old Jewish-Italian boy and an archaeology student in his mid-20s. The Chinese government seems to have split personalities regarding its attitude toward LGBT people. Private consensual adult same-gender sex has not been against the law since 1997, and homosexuality has not been considered to be a mental illness since 2001. However, same-gender relationships are still a generally unspeakable subject in public. Any media portraying abnormal sexual behaviors, including gratuitous displays of sex, have already been banned by the government. And the Communist Party's propaganda department took complete control of film, news, and publishing in early March. An LGBT conference in China's western city of Chengdu was canceled last year after government authorities reportedly pressured venues into canceling their bookings. The lesbian dating app Rela was also shut down last year. But the Chinese government is said to have a financial stake in Blued, billed as the world's largest online gay male dating site that's especially popular across Asia. Jin Ying, executive director of the Beijing LGBT Center, told Reuters that there is no clear policy on this issue, so we are always confused.
We have follow-ups on a couple of stories we told you about in previous newscasts. A federal judge this week threw out a lawsuit filed by anti-queer activist Chris Sevier, who complained last year about four Democratic members of Congress displaying rainbow flags outside their offices. His lawsuit claimed that homosexuality is a religion and that the flag displays violated the constitutionally mandated separation of church and state. Judge Randolph D. Moss of the U.S. District Court for Washington, D.C., decided that Sevier offered no legal support for his positions and said that the LGBT struggle for equality bears no trappings of religion, as that concept is widely understood. And Sevier has not plausibly alleged that a reasonable person would perceive the display of the rainbow flags as religious in nature.
And a first-ever pride parade was held in Starkville, Mississippi on March 24th. Lawmakers there made headlines for first denying a special event permit for Starkville Pride, and then, after being sued by high-profile attorney Roberta Kaplan, reversing course and issuing the permit. Mayor Lynn Spruill, a supporter of the Pride Parade, told the Associated Press that about 2,500 people marched peacefully, many with rainbow balloons, some on roller skates. Several walked with their dogs behind a sign that read, "Unleash Pride." A single protester picketed the event with the sign that called homosexuality an abomination. The Starkville Daily News proclaimed it the biggest parade in city history.
Another town is planning to host its first ever LGBT Pride Parade. It's Columbus, Indiana, the hometown of U.S. Vice President Mike Pence. The event is being organized by Erin Bailey as her high school senior project. She told the Huffington Post that just because Pence is known for his unabashed opposition to LGBTQ rights, that doesn't mean that all of us in his hometown are. We want to show our support as an all-inclusive community. The parade is planned for April 14th. A spokeswoman for Pence said that he is heartened to see young people from his hometown getting involved in the political process.
And finally, Pence will need to keep his stiff upper lip. Will & Grace co-creator Max Muchnick announced on Twitter this week that he would be sending copies of A Day in the Life of Marlon Bundo to every elementary school in Indiana. The children's book published by TV humorist John Oliver parodies a children's book by Pence's daughter about the family's pet rabbit. In Oliver's book, Marlon Bundo is gay and meets the male bunny of his dreams.
My name is Marlon Bundo.
My name is Wesley.
A Pence-like stink bug who opposes their desire to get married is the villain of the story. Muchnick wrote to each elementary school in the state, all 1,121 of them, to say that I would like to donate this copy of A Day in the Life of Marlon Brando to your library. He told The Hollywood Reporter that if this book can help one boy or girl in Indiana love and accept who they are, I know both Marlon Brandos would be proud, even though one of them is on the down low.
That's News Wrap, Global Queer News with Attitude, for the week ending March 31st, 2018. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michelle Yater.
And I'm John Dyer V.
This just in. Queer activists are breathing a sigh of relief following a huge win by Costa Rica's ruling Citizen Action Party in the presidential election runoff on April 1st. Former Labor Minister Carlos Alvarado won by a vote of 61-39%. It's a win for the LGBTQ community because the campaign of his opponent, Fabricio Alvarado, no relation, focused almost exclusively on his opposition to a ruling by the Inter-American Court of Human Rights that requires civil marriage to be open to same-gender couples throughout the region. Public opinion polls had called the race a toss-up.
Straight military personnel will have to shower with homosexuals.
What do you think goes wrong when people shower with homosexuals? Do you think it's the spray makes it catching? I mean, we don't get ourselves dry cleaned.
Hello, I'm Barney Frank, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
Do you remember the passage of Clause 28, the AIDS memorial quilt, or what happened after the cops walked into Michael Hardwick's bedroom? If so, you've been following international LGBTQ events as long as This Way Out has, since April 1st, 1988.
Whether that was before your time or not, we think you'll be amazed to hear what the world was like during our first 6 months on the air as we commemorate This Way Out's 30th anniversary.
Earlier this year, Parliament approved Clause 28 in the United Kingdom, which prohibits municipal funding of any group or activity which promotes homosexuality. Over 50,000 demonstrated against Clause 28 in London.
On its way, the march stopped outside Prime Minister Thatcher's residence in Downing Street, where the marchers made their feelings on this new legislation very clear. Bringing a message of solidarity from gay and lesbian brothers and sisters in North America was one of the organizers of the 1987 March on Washington, Robin Tyler.
Are they arresting people? Do I want to arrest all the gays and lesbians in England, guys? You're going to have to arrest millions and millions and millions of people. Yeah! We are everywhere! You cannot take us out!
Perry Watkins entered the Army at age 19 as an openly gay man. During a career that spanned 15 years in the military, Watkins received promotions, security clearances, and excellent job evaluations. He never hid that he was gay. He twice re-enlisted. Each time, the Army knew he was homosexual. Yet in 1981, the Pentagon decided that all known homosexuals had to be barred from military service, no matter how exemplary their record. The Army tried to discharge Sergeant Watkins, but Sergeant Watkins took the Army to court. In a seesaw legal battle that so far has lasted 7 years, he has yet to win the right to re-enlist and earn a military pension.
Being black and growing up, looking at it, discrimination is the same. It doesn't matter how you color it, how you paint it. You know, that's why I laugh a lot when people say, well, how can you deal with this, you know, all you've been going through? I grew up black. I've been discriminated against all my life. For somebody to discriminate against me because I'm gay is a joke.
Kate Clinton is a gutsy lady.
She left her job as an English teacher at the age of 30 to become not just a stand-up comedian, but an out-of-the-closet lesbian feminist stand-up comedian.
People assume that as a feminist I'm going to do a lot of anti-male humor. I don't really know him that well to make jokes about him.
Now, I think it's time that we have a new feminist TV network. BTL, praise the lesbians. And we'd have some early morning religious music. Oh, give me that old lesbianism. Give me that old lesbianism.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights.
In a three-day conference this past February, several hundred black lesbians and gay men convened in Los Angeles to discuss the emerging leadership in the black, gay, and lesbian communities throughout the country. Keynote speaker, California Assemblywoman Maxine Waters, challenged the listeners to rid themselves of fear in the face of racism, homophobia, and discrimination.
You're much stronger when you have no fear. You're much stronger when you understand people respect you more when you don't have fear. And you're much stronger when you rid yourself of fear because your natural actions are such that you move like a person without fear. And when people see people who are fearless coming, they get out of the way.
Lavelle Dorsey. Charlie Drucker.
I can't help but walk through those lines and lines and lines of panels and see people that I don't know. And the next thing I know, I'm crying.
On its third stop in the 1988 national tour of 20 American cities, the NAMES Project quilt, memorializing the tens of thousands of men and women who have fallen victim to the AIDS epidemic, made a stop in Phoenix, Arizona, the weekend of April 16th. Housed in the Phoenix Civic Plaza, the massive quilt, in this case, 61 squares of 32 name panels each, served as a quiet testament to the brothers and sisters, the sons and daughters, the mothers and fathers, and the friends and lovers who have died from AIDS.
These panels come from, you know, shirts and pieces of material or the things that were important to these people. That's what these panels are made out of.
I only wish more people in Phoenix had dared to visit this memorial to a war of apathy, indecision, public indifference, and red tape.
Chicago, city of the big shoulders. Making sense from the cornucopia of Chicago's great restaurant scene was the six-month project of Chicago editors and gastronomes Bill McBride and Jim Lasaki. The project culminated in the production of an astounding collection of recipes from 91 top Chicago eating establishments. The proceeds from the new cookbook benefit Chicago House, a not-for-profit corporation that operates residences for persons with AIDS.
We were walking to restaurants in the hot summertime, and when you walk in on a cook on a Saturday afternoon in a very nice restaurant, you know, and he's back there running his kitchen, and in comes this person through the alley back door, because that's how we learned how you get into kitchens, and that's where we needed to be. And there were a couple of times where not the nicest things were said, you know, kind of the spicy comments.
With hunger pains and an urge to make some dishes dirty, in Chicago, the city of the big hips, I'm Barry Wick.
Three gay University of California, Los Angeles students filed suit against Disneyland for not allowing them to slow dance at the Magic Kingdom on April 11th.
We're fighting for the injunction to show Disneyland as well as other businesses of all kinds that you can't just walk all over somebody's civil rights because they're doing something that you don't particularly agree with.
So we gotta fight back. In large numbers, fight back. I can't make it alone. Fight back. In large numbers, together, we can make a safe home. Fight back.
I'm Roman Kalinin from Moscow. You're listening to This Way Out.
The showpiece of the homosexual movement in the United States.
Оставайтесь на нашей волне.
Stay on our wavelength.
we're meandering down memory lane through some highlights of our first 6 months on the air with some of the volunteer correspondents who've made This Way Out possible since April 1988.
First time in Canada that a national political figure, or for that matter a person at the provincial level, did say that he happened to be gay, and so I didn't really know what to expect.
Sten Robinson belongs to the New Democratic Party, the party that traditionally occupies the left of center in Canadian politics.
There's been a very important national debate. Even the kinds of very, very homophobic attitudes that have been displayed on the part of some, it's not a bad thing to have them exposed. And at the same time, I've just been enormously encouraged by the phone calls, the letters, the telegrams that I've gotten from literally right across the country, every province, every territory, small communities, big cities. It's really been really quite moving.
Initially, I saw the door, it was like partially cracked, and the door opened a bit. I looked up and nobody was there, and I didn't think anything of it. And I went back to having mutual oral sex with this man for about 45 seconds, and then all of a sudden I looked up again, and there was this officer standing in my bedroom door. And I asked him what he was doing there. It seemed like a pretty reasonable question.
Hardwick filed a civil suit at the Federal District Court to challenge the Georgia sodomy statute so that the kinds of intrusions into his bedrooms would cease. Unfortunately, he lost.
Get the court! Out of our bedrooms! Get the court! Out of our bedrooms!
Hardwick is a decision that relegates gay men and lesbians to the status of criminals in 25 states in the District of Columbia because of who we love.
Oklahoma, crime against nature, 10 years. Rhode Island, crime against nature, 7 years minimum.
We want the Supreme Court out of our bedrooms. We want the government and police out of our bedrooms. We want the rights that all Americans want, including the most fundamental and basic of all rights, which is the right to be left alone.
Ain't no court supreme enough. Ain't no court supreme enough. Ain't no court supreme enough to keep me from my dreams. Ain't no court supreme enough.
No, no.
Ain't no court supreme enough. Ain't no court
no
supreme
way
enough
to
keep me from my
want equal rights, so should we have queers as cops?
They're out of their head. They are wrong.
I think it's stupid.
Yeah, if they want to do their thing, let them go someplace else.
They want us to do what they want, and we don't want to do that.
They like for people to be gay.
The way they're dressing, the way they're waving their arms at you.
Why don't you do things the way God made us to do it?
God gave
is your mother and father a lesbian?
I know. God does not want two girls and two guys doing what half these people here are doing. They need help. Any person who is gay is sick.
My sweet fairy, how long will you run? No hiding place. Over there,
where will you be when they come? They will not come a mob rolling through the streets, but quickly and quietly move into our homes to remove the evil, the queerness, the faggotry from their midst. They will not come clothed in brown and swastikas or bearing chests heavy with gleaming crosses. The time and need for such ruses are over. They will come in business suits to buy your homes and bring bodies to fill your jobs. They will come in robes to rehabilitate and white coats to subjugate? And where will you be when they come? Where will we all be when they come? And they will come. They will come because we are defined as opposite, perverse. And we are perverse. Every time we watched a queer hassled in the streets and said nothing, it was an act of perversion. Every time we lied about the boyfriend or girlfriend at coffee break, it was an act of perversion. Every time we heard, "I don't mind gays, but why must they be blatant?" and said nothing, it was an act of perversion. Every time we let a lesbian mother lose her child and did not fill the courtrooms, it was an act of perversion. Every time we let straights make out in our bars while we couldn't touch because of the laws, it was an act of perversion. Every time we let straight relatives bury our dead and push our lovers away, it was an act of perversion. And they will come for the perverts. And it won't matter if you're homosexual, not a faggot, lesbian, not a dyke, gay, not queer. It won't matter if you own your own business, have a good job, or an SSI. It won't matter if you're black, Chicano, Native American, Asian, or white. It won't matter if you're from New York or Los Angeles, Galveston, or Sioux Falls. It won't matter if you're butch or femme, not into roles, monogamous, non-monogamous. It won't matter if you're Catholic, Baptist, atheist, Jewish, or MCC. They will come. They will come to the cities and to the land, to your front rooms and in your closets. They will come for the perverts. And where will you be when they come?
You've been listening to highlights from This Way Out's first 6 months on the air in 1988. Clause 28 and the Hardwick decision both went down to defeat in 2003.
Sergeant Perry Watkins won reinstatement in the Army in 1990, but died of AIDS in 1996.
Former British Columbia MP Sven Robinson now works for the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria.
Poet Pat Parker died of breast cancer in 1989.
Disneyland's popular Gay Days remain unofficial, but 2018 marks the 28th annual Gay Day at Disney World.
Humorist Kate Clinton is on a digital sabbatical this year while keeping her hand in politics.
And Congresswoman Maxine Waters, musician Mary Watkins, and This Way Out are still going strong.
This Way Out's 30th anniversary bash continues throughout the month of April.
I think I'll take a moment, celebrate my age, the ending of an era and the turning of a page. Now it's time to focus in on where I go from here. Lord, have mercy on my next 30 years.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from John Dyer V and Michelle Yeager, with thanks to Steve Pride. Our 6 month correspondents included Tim Richardson, Robin McCall, Anthony Price, Christopher McPherson, Barry Wick, Andrew Ross Exler, Rob Atkinson, Alan Ross, and John Zay.
Teresa Troll, Bob Marley, Reflex, Holly Mear, Diana Ross, The Bobby Fuller Four, Janice Lieber, and Chopped Liver Productions, Mary Watkins,
and Tim McGraw
performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music.
This Way Out thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who makes this program possible.
ThisWayOut.org has a fresh new look in celebration of our 30th anniversary, so come by and join the party.
Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google Plus. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA.
For everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org
and on WWUH West Hartford, Connecticut,
Wild Planet Radio, Portland, Oregon,
5CST Southwest Adelaide, South Australia,
and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station.
Do stay tuned
for our next 30 years.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. If the brave new world predicted by futurists comes true, in which robots take most of our jobs, what political system might we end up with? Will it be one where the absence of waged work frees us, or where we face even bleaker prospects than the present? In Four Futures, Life After Capitalism, published by Verso, Peter Fraze imagines a quartet of possible societies, two based on abundance and two on scarcity. Peter, since the early days of capitalism, capitalists have tried to replace workers with machines. Also, since the early days of capitalism, there have been predictions that workers will be made permanently unemployed by machines. But on the whole, new jobs have arisen, albeit often poorly paid, to replace those rendered obsolete by machines. Why should it be different this time around?
It shouldn't necessarily. The way I would put it is that, to slightly reframe the way you've laid it out, there has been throughout the history of capitalism a struggle, a contentious question running through the development of capitalist economies, which is, as productivity increases, as new technologies are developed, as certain kinds of work are replaced by machines, is that going to lead to a future in which we have more material prosperity and also more free time for all, or simply higher profits for the few and new kinds of drudgery for the many? I think that's the same question now as it was 200 years ago, even if the particular kinds of jobs that are being automated or the particular kinds of technologies being introduced have changed.
But it seems like what you're arguing is something momentous is in the works, whether or not it is happening right now, that it points to a very different kind of future or possible futures, and you talk about multiple futures. Why do you think something of significance is taking place?
Well, I suppose partly because we're seeing a lot of a lot of energy, a lot of mental energy, a lot of anxieties, a lot of hopes also emanating both from the sphere of workers and workers' movements, but also from capitalists and, you know, people and also, you know, mainstream economists wondering if, well, maybe this is going to be the time when it's different and we're not necessarily going to develop some new kind of mass labor that's going to employ all of the people who will be displaced by everything from AI algorithms that parse medical records to self-driving trucks that throw out of work truck drivers, which is the biggest category, biggest single category of labor in the United States. And so there is this question that's being put on the table and being addressed in different ways from across the political spectrum. In that case, if it is the case that there is some possibility, even if it's not yet a reality, if there is some possibility of very rapid mass unemployment, then what does that mean? What do we do about it? And so you have everyone from Bill Gates to, you know, people on the labor left wondering about this question and trying to put forward ideas of what we might do to address it if the old social democratic, we just need to have, you know, high wages and good unions and we can have a good welfare state. If that's not enough, then what's the answer?
Why do you assume, and this is the premise for your book, for futures, that capitalism will end? Is there something inherent about increasing automation? Is it something else? Why is that the starting point for your imaginings here?
I mean, I suppose it's just motivated by looking at the history of human societies and human social formation to begin with and saying that none of them have lasted forever. Some of them lasted for thousands of years, but ultimately they were displaced or they were conquered or they collapsed or they fell apart for one reason or another. And capitalism is distinguished by its speed, its dynamism, its acceleration. This is one of the things that the proponents of capitalism like to raise in its defense and to promote it, to say this is the most dynamic. It is the social form that has been able to revolutionize society more than any other. And Karl Marx, of course, said similar things about it in his writings. But that also means that it's a volatile, an unstable system. And I think we're seeing both in it internally in terms of its economics, in terms of things like the recent financial crisis and all the previous economic crises that we have seen, that is always subject to those kinds of breakdowns, depressions, bankruptcy, unemployment, all of that. And that also now increasingly we're seeing the ecological limit of this system, that a system which is premised, as capitalism is, on constant growth can, although I will say not necessarily, but can easily run up against the limit of what the planet can sustain in terms of carbon-based fossil fuels running a system based on this kind of process of constant growth. And so those are the reasons why I look at it and say, not that I'm going to predict necessarily. I don't want to predict. Part of the point of the book was to not predict, but rather to open a space of possibilities. But to say it's hard to see how you can imagine capitalism, as we understand it anyway, persisting as an eternal social system, right? Like if every other social system that we know of ultimately passed into the pages of history, of all of them, capitalism is the one that I think we can least imagine doing so, or persisting beyond. You know, maybe it'll last another generation, maybe it'll last several more, maybe it'll collapse tomorrow. I'm not saying that I know that, but that the system has to end.
What do you think are the limitations of predicting the future based on technology separate from considering relationships of power, as you can find in a lot of the writings about our automated future? The idea is the kind of society or societies we're going to end up will be dictated by technological change.
Well, It is a shortcoming, certainly, of many mainstream commentaries on technology and mainstream economics writing on technology, but also of certain kinds of left and socialist and Marxist writings, that they see technology as a thing that comes in from the outside, as something that's essentially exogenous to the system. So a technology appears, and then that changes society and changes history in some way. And I think it's more useful to think about it, particularly when you're talking about something like a capitalist economy, in which the key technologies relate to production and relate to technologies as they interact with human workers. It's more useful to think about technical development as something that happens in interaction with political movements and workers' movements and labor movements, so that the kinds of technologies you get and the kinds of technologies that are deployed are in many ways functions of how workers are organized and how they struggle. So that, for example, one thing that I raise is this question that is often brought up about the whole idea that we are about, the thing you brought up earlier, this whole idea that we are about to be in this robot apocalypse where all the jobs are automated and all the jobs disappear. And it has been pointed out by many critics on the left, Doug Henwood, Dean Baker, others, that this is not reflected, in fact, in the statistics on productivity, where you would expect to find, if this was actually happening, that labor, the productivity, that is, how much you can produce per unit hour of labor, should be rapidly rising as the machines become more and more able to replace human labor or to very efficiently use human labor. Sure. And you don't see that. In fact, productivity growth has been quite low in recent years, certainly compared to the 90s, compared to the post-war boom. And the way I kind of view that is, well, what's going on here? I think the most plausible story that's going on here, which you can get from me, you can get from the economist J.W. Mason and other people, is that the incentive for bosses, for owners, for capitalists to economize on labor, in other words, to replace as many workers as they can with machines, is related to how cheap and how easy to control those workers are. So if your workers are weak, if your workers are cheap, if the wages are low, then why would you replace the worker with the machine? Just use the cheap worker. And so those dynamics, I think, are what drive the process forward, as well as the question of, well, there's technology and then there's technology. There's a machine that can replace a worker and therefore, at least in principle, increase our material standard of living. And then there's a machine or a program or an algorithm that serves only to increase the profit of the boss without actually making anything more efficient per se. Things like different kinds of surveillance technologies that allow bosses to monitor every microsecond of their workers' lives. It allows them to manipulate and control workers, but it doesn't necessarily increase our overall social wealth. So I think that's how I view this relationship between technology and society, rather than technology being this asteroid that just sort of comes in and hits us and that has nothing to do with our social relations.
Your starting point is that, in thinking about four different possible futures, is that they all are premised on the idea that human labor in the future will be completely replaceable by machines. And two of those futures are based on abundance, and two are based on scarcity. And so I want to start by talking about the societies based on abundance, beginning with a society based on abundance and equality, namely communism. How do you imagine such a society to look like in the future?
Well, as it's sort of one of the starting points of this entire book and this entire project, the short answer is Star Trek. And for any listener who has not seen it, the world of the future as portrayed in the show Star Trek is one in which they have essentially unlimited free energy based on some kind of antimatter, something or other, and also completely automated production based on something called the replicator, which is essentially, if you took what our contemporary 3D printers and generalized that to the point where you can literally press a button and make anything you want, whether it's food or it's clothing or it's whatever. And so this is a world in which it is not any longer necessary to answer this question of who does what jobs to make sure that the widgets get made, and who makes what widgets, and how do we decide that, and who gets them, and so on. And the thing that I think I bring to it that you don't necessarily get either in Star Trek or in a lot of other post-scarcity speculations is the idea that this only happens, this only works, if you're able to overcome the class contradiction of the society that we live in now. In other words, just because you have that technology, even if we found the antimatter reactors and the replicators tomorrow, that doesn't mean we all then immediately go to the promised land of post-scarcity in which, you know, we can either hang around and, you know, lie in a hammock, or we can get on a spaceship and fly around the galaxy if that's our predilection. You don't get that automatically. You have to actually overthrow the property relations, the class relations, the power relations that currently rule our world, because those technologies will be in our world, would be owned by somebody, would be controlled by somebody. And so the argument about communism is that this is the world of Star Trek, if you will, that we could get to, but that getting there is both a technological and a political question. And I'll just real add into that. You mentioned this is the world of abundance, and abundance in my framework here means a particular thing, not just abundance in the sense of we have unlimited energy and resources to replicate things, but also abundance in the sense that we've overcome, in some sense, the ecological crisis, meaning getting to a post-carbon future, cleaning up the damage that has already been done to the planet, reconstructing our infrastructure, all of that sort of thing. So it's that is the particular thing that I'm thinking about, that it's imagining that we have not only overcome the need for human labor, but that we've also overcome the ecological contradiction.
Peter Fraze is my guest. We're talking about his book, Four Futures, Life After Capitalism. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So one of the questions that comes up in your imagining of a communist future is that of work and the value of work, because you are picturing a society where work, human work, has been replaced by machines. And it is a great distance from the nostalgic idea of guild labor and work, albeit crafts work, as a transcendent experience that one finds in, say, William Morris's famous imagining of a communist future, News from Nowhere, but you don't have to go to those extremes. In the Marxist tradition and outside of it, there is a lot of emphasis, or has been, on work as a value in itself, and to not be working, to imagine a society where people are not working, can be kind of unsettling.
Work has become an extremely mystified concept in late capitalism, especially, I would say, because it's often invoked as though work is the sort of end of human existence, or the way in which people realize themselves. But when people talk about work, it often runs together a bunch of different things in an incoherent way. People talk about work when they mean the things that must be done in order for a society to persist or to be reproduced, whether that's raising crops or building roads or raising children, or they are referring to whatever it is that people do that pays them a wage. So, for example, you have people on the left now that advocate the so-called job guarantee, where the government creates a job for you if a private capitalist does not, if you can't find a job in the private market. And this is sort of abstracted from the idea of what the job is or what the content is. The idea is that there's some dignity to just doing something for pay for somebody else. And that might overlap with the first category of things that are actually what we might regard as socially necessary, although, of course, socially necessary is a politically contested category. But it doesn't have to overlap with it. And in the case of certain obvious things, I would say, like being a hedge fund trader or a prison guard or something, it certainly does not overlap with it. And then in the third category, and this is where I think the speculations about a post-capitalist future are most important, is the category of what it is that we do that gives us that sense of dignity and meaning and worth in life. And that's often conflated with either something that is socially necessary or something that is paid. But I don't think there's any reason that it has to be. And I'm suggesting that we can imagine a future in which it is completely disconnected from those things. I don't think that's totally disconnected from where we are today, in the sense that how many people are really more invested than anything else in their hobbies, in their non-waged activities, in playing the guitar or tending their backyard gardens, to just name those that are of interest to me. And so those things are work in a sense. They're work in the sense that they require some discipline and some practice and some effort, but they are not work in the sense necessarily that you get paid for them. And so I think a lot of the sort of anxiety about, well, what, you know, how can you imagine a society without work stems from this category confusion, this mystification of what work is, which is not to say, to go back to the question about automation, it's not to say that I really believe, even though it's the premise of my book, it's intentionally an exaggerated premise, I don't necessarily believe that we can actually eliminate, and in fact I say in the book, we can't actually eliminate all work whatsoever. It's almost logically impossible unless we want to live in the matrix where the machines control us rather than the other way around. At the very least, the work of deciding what the machines do is a labor. But I do want to open the possibility of a world in which we imagine the content of our time, the content of our lives, as something other than working for someone else for a paycheck. Even if the content of that life is as simple as and as complex as simply taking care of ourselves and one another, building a more sociable and caring kind of society.
So is the crucial question here whether one gets a wage in terms of defining work, or could it be work that is productive, that is unwaged? Because I could imagine people could balk at the idea of a future, let's say, utopian society, using that in the broad sense, where they would not be dependent on work for a wage, but they still have some investment in productive activity, however defined.
Yeah, well, I guess the question is, what is the reason for us to be invested in productive activity, however defined? Is it because there are certain things that need to be done? And I certainly think that is a question that arises in a lot of speculations about the transition out of capitalism, particularly when you're talking about wage and unwaged work and the work that is predominantly done by women and how the tasks are distributed, and, you know, how we answer the question of who does whatever work still needs to be done. There's a politics to that. And part of my argument is that we need to criticize wage labor and argue for ways of decommodifying it and detaching people from the need to perform wage labor, precisely so that we can ask those questions about what is actually the necessary labor and who's doing it. But then there's another aspect of this, which is that people need to feel they're doing something quote unquote productive. And I think that is actually tied to very particular constructions and often sort of masculinized constructions of what productive labor is, which are tied to wage labor, which are tied to particular kinds of labor, in a way that I think is very mystified, and that I see it as the task of critics of capitalism to try to demystify and to criticize this idea that there's some kind of security blanket of I am a productive worker that you can cling on to without having to look too deeply into what is it that really does make you a productive worker.
Well, staying for a moment more with the future of communism, one of equality and abundance, you argue that contrary to the assumptions that tend to be made about communism as an ideal society, that when we think about equality under communism, we shouldn't assume that all hierarchies disappear.
Right. I think there's a kind of stereotype about communism or egalitarian futures more generally that imagines we all wear the same gray jumpsuit and get the same gruel from the cafeteria and that that's equality. Whereas my conception of it is more that we're breaking apart the master hierarchies of the society that we live in. So the metaphor that I use is that of the magnet. There's an exercise that's often done in high school or junior high school science classrooms to demonstrate the principle of the magnetic field, in which you lay a magnet down on the table and you drop a bunch of iron filings on top of it. And the filings will arrange themselves into this beautiful pattern that demonstrates the existence of this invisible magnetic field generated by the north and south poles of this magnet. And my argument is that capitalism, and particularly the capital relation between capital and labor, between those who buy labor and those who must sell labor, is sort of something with the force of a magnet in our society, which is to say it doesn't necessarily create or structure completely all the hierarchies that exist, various status hierarchies, things related to various kinds of cultural, religious, race, ethnicity, all the kind of things that come out of various aspects of our history and society. It doesn't create or define all of those things, but it draws them into its magnetic field. It aligns them with that one master hierarchy, the one that says, do you have the money, the means of production, or do you not? And that taking away the magnet doesn't take away all of the hierarchies, all of the status systems. It just takes away that one big structuring system that was drawing them all into its orbit. And so then we are in a world, not one without hierarchies, but where there's no one single hierarchy that you have to be in or out of, one that determines for, you know, one way or another whether you have the means to live. And so I tried to explore in some ways a question that arose when I was talking about the concept of this book and the concept of many things that I've written, where I'm talking about a post-scarcity communist future, and people put to me a question that had not occurred to me. Well, wouldn't it be boring? Wouldn't there not be kind of something to live for or compete for or fight for? I thought, I'm not worried about that. I think humans are great at coming up with things to rate each other on and compete for. I just don't want to live in a world where that's a life or death question all the time, whether you're on top or on the bottom of any particular hierarchy, whether it's having the most likes on Twitter or being the best at a particular video game, you know?
Indeed. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. Today, we're talking about the book Four Futures, Life After Capitalism. That's published by Verso, and its author is Peter Fraze. He's a member of the editorial board of Jacobin. So let's talk about the second society that you explore, the second possible future based on abundance. And this is one where hierarchy is central, along with abundance, and where the means of generating abundance are held by a small elite. Tell us more about what such a society might look like, and why do you call it rentism?
So this bit is the origin of the entire project, in fact, because it came out of me thinking, again, about Star Trek, as I mentioned earlier, as this vision of a post-scarcity society, but looking at it with my Marxist glasses on and saying, well, the technology does not imply necessarily this particular egalitarian form of society. What would happen if our present elite of, you know, Silicon Valley overlords had their hands on the replicator and the antimatter energy and all the rest of it, and wanted to stay on top, wanted to remain a ruling class? And my answer to that was that they needed specifically intellectual property to stay on top of this. And the reason I call this particular future rentism is because the analysis of intellectual property, to me, turns on the concept of rent. And, of course, rent in the popular sense and also in its sort of historic origins mostly refers to rent on land. You know, the fact that a landlord can extract a certain amount of money from anyone that wants to live on or farm on or build on their land. But the concept, as has been elaborated, you know, from David Ricardo to Karl Marx to David Harvey, It's a broader concept. And even some libertarians have pointed out this particular fact about rent as a particular form that arises from a particular form of property. So the distinction is that there is one form of property in which you own a physical object. And if somebody tries to take that object from you, you can call the cops and they will come and take that person away for taking the object that you own. There's another form of property in which you own not an object, but rather the form of the object, the pattern of the object, the concept of the object. So it's not that I own a pair of shoes, it's that I own the pattern to produce that pair of shoes. And that is a form of property that gives rise to rent, because unlike the physical form in which you can make money in the traditional capitalist way by, you know, having a factory where you put out some widgets and you sell the widgets and then you make the money from the widget. Instead, you now own the rights to anytime anybody downloads a copy of a certain movie, you are supposed to get a payoff. And in the world I'm imagining, where we have these replicators, except in a corporatized world, then, well, you have a replicator and it can make you a pair of shoes, but you have to put in your credit card because somebody else owns the right to the pattern that makes those shoes, even though they don't do anything to make any particular one of those copies. They just own the right to generally any copy of those shoes that ever exists anywhere for all time. And so this gives rise to the world that I originally, before I wrote this book, called anti-Star Trek, and then I eventually came to call rentism, because it is a world based on a form of class power and a form of accumulation, not based on the direct production of physical commodities, but on the rights to produce those commodities that are then licensed to others.
Well, along with rentism and communism, you imagine in For Futures two other futures, but these two, unlike the first two, are not based on abundance, but on scarcity. They are socialism and exterminism. Going with socialism for a minute, based on equality and scarcity, how does socialism differ from communism?
It differs primarily because it centers the ecological reconstruction of the world. It centers on, again, not on the management of labor, because, once again, I've presupposed that we can put that out of the picture, not to say that I think that's a total, I think that's a hyperbolic assumption, but I put it out of the picture in order to put a different thing into the picture, which is both the management of consumption and the healing and reconstruction of the earth in the wake of fossil fuel capitalism. And so here, a bunch of things are going on. And this is also the chapter that does the most things to piss people off, so I don't know how many of them we want to get into, but one of the things is that, you know, maybe we do need some work here. It just won't be the kind of work that we had before. It is going to be rebuilding our infrastructure, rebuilding our energy grid, all those sorts of things. There might be a role for markets here, not necessarily in the way that they work in a capitalist society, particularly because the thing about markets in a capitalist society, the problem with them is not so much that there's a market with a price mechanism. The problem is that not everybody has the same amount of money when they come to the market. So my dollar and Bill Gates' dollar don't mean the same thing to us by far. But if the question is, we all have the same amount of eco credits and we can't all just consume as much as we want, but we have to have some mechanism of deciding, well, can I have another new iPhone? Can I go on a transatlantic flight? Well, maybe a market mechanism can help us out with that. So I make that argument. And then I also get into this question of how deeply are we going to engage in intentionally altering the physical and natural world, or what's sometimes called geoengineering, which is a very controversial term, and it's associated with a lot of right-wing or capitalist ideas. But it's essentially saying capitalism has now Industrial capitalism has now put us on a path where we have irrevocably transformed the environment of the earth in ways where, even if we somehow went to zero carbon emissions tomorrow, is irreversible. And so in addition to getting off of this carbon system as fast as possible, we need to think about how, instead of sort of unintentionally or as a side effect transforming the climate, we are going to have to take affirmative actions to try to counteract what's been done, whether that is by something as sort of low-key as planting trees, which absorb carbon, or by having planes flying around spraying particles into the atmosphere to diminish the amount of solar energy that hits the planet. And so I kind of raise those issues as the kind of thing that a global socialist society would need to reckon with, even in the absence of the problem of the management of human labor.
In your chapter that focuses on a socialist future and these challenges of handling scarcity and the wreckage of ecological devastation, you draw from the work of Kim Stanley Robinson, the Marxist science fiction writer. And I wondered if you could talk about why you did that there. And throughout the book, you've obviously mentioned Star Trek. Why do you look to, in a work that is grounded in radical theory, why are you looking toward speculative fiction as a useful tool in thinking about these futures?
Part of it is just that I love speculative fiction. But the other reason is that I, on the one hand, I'm thinking about the future in a way that I think any radical must. Marxism itself is a kind of science fiction, I think. But there's also that line, the famous line of Marx's, that we're not to be writing recipes for the kitchens of the future.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that the future is open-ended and contingent, and that to try to predict it makes you into what I derisively call a futurist, which is to say the kind of person who writes airport bookstore books that say, here's what's going to happen in 20 years and how you can profit from it. And the problem with that is, one, the predictions never pan out.
Indeed.
But two, that it also contradicts the democratic premise of the kind of politics that I want to put forward, which is that actually the future is in the hands of the masses who will make it. So it would be logically contradictory for me to claim that I knew what that future was going to be. However, we still need ways to imagine that future. And this is where I think science fiction or speculative fiction is inherently superior to the more rigid kinds of futurism, is that it paints pictures of possible worlds, possible places we could go, without saying these are predictions. It's saying these are ways to imagine how things could be different that are still grounded enough in our world that you can sort of see how you could get from where we are to where they are. And so you raised Kim Stanley Robinson, who I rely upon a lot in my chapter on socialism. And he wrote the Mars Trilogy, which is one of the ones I talk about a lot, which is a series of books about the terraforming of Mars. In other words, transforming Mars from its current state as a basically desiccated red planet, enough buildable for life, into a planet that people could live on. The books are called Red Mars, Blue Mars, Green Mars, talking about bringing water to Mars, bringing, you know, green plant life to Mars. And the argument that I make, and the reason that I deploy him in that particular chapter where I'm talking about things like geoengineering and the manipulation of the natural environment on Earth, is to say these are best understood or most usefully understood as kinds of metaphors, because unlike some of my more science fiction-oriented comrades on the left, I don't think we're going to Mars, or I don't think we should go to Mars anyway. I don't think that should be what we're thinking about. I think we should instead be thinking about the idea of terraforming Mars into a human habitable environment as a sort of metaphor for terraforming Earth, turning our own environment into one that we can continue to live on, given what's been done to it by the last few hundred years of human history.
In your book, Four Futures, and I should say that I'm speaking with Peter Fraze, who is a member of the editorial board of Jacobin, In Four Futures, the fourth future is the bleakest, one that combines both scarcity and hierarchy. You ominously call it exterminism. What would that society look like, and how would it be structured?
First of all, apologies to the great British Marxist E.P. Thompson, who coined the term exterminism. He was referring to the threat of nuclear war in the early 1980s, and I appropriated his term for something different, but arguably even scarier. It is the question of what happens when you break apart a great premise of the left and the workers' movement of the past few centuries. In the terms of the great left standard, solidarity forever, they have taken untold millions that they never toiled to earn, but without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel can turn. In other words, we need the bosses because we don't own the means of production. We don't have any other way to earn a living. But they need us, because who's going to run the factories? Who's going to run the shops? So what my chapter on exterminism supposes is, well, what if they don't need our brain and muscle anymore? They have robots and algorithms to do that. Then what happens? And what happens, I suggest, is that they retreat into their gated communities. They retreat to their private islands. They have drones. They have robocops to defend themselves from us. And for a while, we get warehoused. We get imprisoned. We get put in camps. We live in the parts of the earth that are getting ravaged by climate change while the rich get to retreat to their castles. But eventually, billions of superfluous people are a danger, even in the most futurist society you can imagine. And so the end logic of this is genocidal. It's exterminate these people. And as with all my other futures, the point is to say that this is an extrapolation and it's extreme, but it's also meant to remind you and to make you think about things that exist in our world, whether it's the conflicts going on around resources throughout Central Africa, whether it's the Gaza Strip, whether it's the prison industrial complex in the United States. And so those things are all meant to make you think about what happens to people when they are simply not useful to capitalism anymore.
So could you tell us in more detailed terms what you could imagine the society that you term exterminism to look like? This is one where hierarchy and scarcity are combined in a world where population has radically contracted. What do you think the contours of such a society would look like ultimately?
I think of it sort of like the fantasies that you sometimes today see coming out of Silicon Valley, especially. There was a few years back a famed or infamous speech where one of these CEOs from a tech company in Silicon Valley pretty much fantasized about seceding from society and going to live on an island or an oil rig or something, because in his mind, you know, he didn't need any of us parasites and government or any of that, because it was only the heroic capitalist elite that produced anything anyway. And it's fantastic and delusional, because and many people can tell you, these people who live in San Francisco and work making crappy apps for Silicon Valley don't actually exist independent of the society that supports them. But my premise here was that what if that was true? What if they could really do it? Because clearly there are people that want to do it. And what it would look like is living on private islands, living in gated communities, and then having a lot of drones and robots to defend themselves from the people that were left out, the people that were desperate, the people that were immiserated. That was the conception of it. And that then eventually, if either, you know, eventually they're going to do something about us. They're either going to leave us to die or they're going to kill us off affirmatively if they feel the need to do so. And then either they go at each other's throats, because that's the type of personality that has been produced among this small elite, or they settle into a kind of complacent existence in which they now, you know, enjoy their post-scarcity society and pretend that the genocide never happened.
I'd like to ask you about something which is not necessarily about the far future, but is debated in the present, and that is about the universal basic income. And the reason I'm bringing this up is there are people, certainly many on the left who argue for a universal basic income that would separate people's livelihoods from their wage jobs, that people would get money whether or not they had a wage job. It comes up because in discussions of automation, there are people on the right who also talk positively about a universal basic income, and they worry that robots will end up creating an unemployed rabble. So it's a complicated question, and I wanted to know what you think of it, but related to what you mentioned not too long ago about the song Solidarity Forever and the idea that the capitalist class, we're dependent on them, but on the other hand, they're dependent on us. And is there a danger in reforms that might introduce eventually a universal basic income that might sever us as workers from our traditional position and make the capitalist class less dependent on us?
I will say, first of all, just to my own horn a little bit, I gave a talk about this at the University of Leeds a month or so ago, which you can find a video of online, about precisely the politics of basic income that you're referring to, that there is a right and a left version of it. This is a fairly new phenomenon in terms of mainstream discourse, or even semi-mainstream discourse. When I first started thinking about basic income 10 or more years ago, it was a fringe idea on the left and the right, and rarely talked about. Now it's kind of got a little bit of cachet. And you're right, there's a right-wing and a left-wing version of it. And I'm not so much concerned about what you raised, this idea that it furthers the disconnect between mutual interdependence of capital and labor, because in some ways, I think just about every victory of the working class has that effect in a certain way. It's just another version of what's sometimes called the decommodification of labor. In other words, lessening that degree to which the only way you can survive is to find someone who will hire you and pay you a wage. Universal health care is decommodifying in basically the same way. If you get your health care as of right from the state rather than from your employer, then that lessens that mutual interdependence. I nevertheless think it's a reform worth fighting for. I do think it's important to put basic income in its proper context, which is that it's a useful replacement for certain kinds of paternalistic and controlling kinds of state programs, food stamps and other cash transfers that you have to apply for and meet with caseworkers and jump through various hoops. These kinds of programs that are subject to what I would call maybe a Foucauldian critique of the welfare state, that says that to the extent that you can just give people checks unrestricted rather than making them have to fill all these detailed restrictions, then that is in sort of an increase in freedom. But what we have to be cautious about is the right-wing or the capitalist versions of basic income that say we can just blow up the whole welfare state and replace it with passing out checks. It doesn't work for a bunch of reasons, one of which is just that the size of the check's not going to make up for the amount of the budget they want to cut, and the other one being that there are certain things like health care, for example, where giving everyone an equal amount of money to buy health care is not, in fact, egalitarian, because we don't all need the same amount of health care. Some people are bearing children. Some people are not. Some people have cancer. Some people do not. So that's just like, from a principled, moral, left egalitarian perspective, is a non-starter for me. But that doesn't mean that basic income, as a part of a larger package of demands, shouldn't be part of our argument, partly because I think it does have both a functional and a rhetorical value as saying we live in a rich society and we just all deserve some minimal level of living.
In thinking about four different possible futures, if we end up with one of these futures, will that be the end of the story? Could the future hold more than one?
More than one, all of them, or one leading into the other? I tried to add a little plot twist. I guess, spoiler alert, I'm going to tell you what I do at the end of the book, where I suggest that these are not necessarily neat morality plays. You can imagine the communist future that we began with, this world where everybody is just chilling. They got their replicators. They're just like running Disneyland for fun, which happens in a Cory Doctorow novel that I use in that chapter as one of the illustrations, everything's great, right? Well, how did we get here? And one explanation of how we got here is that there used to be a lot more people on Earth, but we went through the exterminist period in which they all were left to die of, you know, preventable diseases or were actively killed off through various kinds of militaristic and carceral strategies. And then, once all the extra people were dead, we were living in a communist utopia. And, of course, this is another feature of our present that we don't like to think about the histories that led up to the society that we live in, certainly as an American, the histories of colonization and genocide. And so that's sort of the last turn of the screw that I want to make. Not only are all the futures here, not only is it the case in the William Gibson quote that I love that the future is here, it's just unequally distributed, it is also the case that there are very complicated, morally complicated, snaking paths between the different futures that I'm talking about, interactions between the futures that I'm talking about that don't just fall into these are the good ones, these are the bad ones.
How do you think how we imagine the future or don't imagine the future, how does it affect radical politics today? I mean, you mentioned earlier that you would warn us away from mapping out blueprints for the future, that we need to recognize the need for people to shape their own future as they're making it. But at the same time, there's a kind of thick fog of despair that hangs over a lot of our societies and a lot of the left about the future. It's hard to imagine a future that's not going to be worse than the present. How do you think, in picturing these futures, which are starkly different from each other, is there a political value in thinking about the future and stretching our minds around the different possibilities?
I think there is. And I think the key question is to imagine a future. In my more mundane local political work, one of the questions I'd like to ask when we're having meetings of my socialist organization is to have everyone go around, introduce themselves, and say, you know, who they are. And then the question is, what do you do after the revolution? Meaning, you don't have to go to a job you probably don't like, and you don't have to show up at socialist meetings. What do you want to do? And that's an entry point to thinking about what the whole point of our politics is, that's actually about positively what we want rather than negatively what we don't want. And to take that then to a more abstract or more conceptual level, I've been influenced by some of the work you yourself have done about catastrophism and the problems that arise when you have a left that is rooted in simply talking about how bad everything is and how ruined everything is and how screwed we all are, which no matter how true it is on some level, ends up functioning as an alibi for an action. It ends up functioning as a way for people to say, well, it's all done. It's all over. What's the point? And I think it's a very kind of narcissistic and self-serving thing compared to saying, well, no, it's not all over. And if I take action, I might screw up and I might do it wrong, but that's my actual moral responsibility.
Peter, thank you so much for joining me.
It's been a pleasure, Sasha. Thanks for having me on.
I've been speaking this hour with Peter Fraes. He is the author of Four Futures, Life After Capitalism. That's published by Verso, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He's a member of the editorial board at Jacobin Magazine. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.